The Devil Prayed and Darkness Fell, written by David Corbett, performed by David DeVries. 1. From the way the woman fixed her eyes on me as I entered the courtroom, I had a suspicion she'd been waiting. I paid her no mind at first, and instead went up to counsel's table, conveyed the information I'd promised, pulled the full report from my briefcase and handed it over, then turned back around to leave. She sat there, still staring, like this was church and one of the plaster saints had stepped down from its nave. As I came nearer, I smiled and nodded toward the hallway, suggesting she follow, then waited just outside. She slipped out the thick wood door as though afraid the slightest peep might bring the majesty of justice crumbling down. She was African-American, 30 or so, elegant hands but the eyes of a ghost, shapeless wool beret and corduroy coat, the single mom shoulder bag, the sensible shoes. "Mr. Phelan?" "Tierney," I said, a common mistake. I crafted the smile I've perfected from habit. "Phelan's my first name." She nodded primly.
"I apologize."
"No, please, it's a silly name. Can I..."
"I'm Marshalene Whalen."
She glanced back and forth down the hallway, making sure no one stood too close.
"My brother is Raymond Kersey."
For the briefest moment, I entertained the notion that she didn't look like much of a cop killer's sister. Absurd thing to think. How was she supposed to look?
"Would it be possible, Mr. Tierney, if it's not an imposition, I mean?"
She swallowed a lump of air, fiddled with her purse strap.
"Might I have, maybe, just a moment of your time?"
In the month since that awkward first exchange, as I did what I could to help her and the brother she continues to love, not the majority view, I assure you, I've come to realize that my fleeting idiocy as she approached me that day, in fact, speaks to something largely unexamined and insidious. Call it the curse of assured expectation, the blithe confidence that life makes sense. We've seen it all before, or most of it anyway. And by golly, we've got this funny little world and its curious ways commendably sussed out. A neat little trick of the mind. And it grants us all kinds of permission. In particular, it sanctions that sneaky, contemptible thing we do dozens, even hundreds of times a day. Judge others. Just as that same dishonest logic allows them to judge us. But there in the courthouse corridor, after that initial mental glitch, the chief impression of Marshalene Whalen that came to my mind was that I doubted I'd ever encountered anyone fully clothed who seemed so naked. The bulkiness of her coat suggested she'd lost considerable weight. The angles of her face looked drawn and unnatural. Her eyes swelled with such a worn-out, fragile concern they almost swallowed you whole, dragging you down into the directionless nowhere that now defined her life. She reached out, took my hand, as though the next thing she said required a bond between people she feared might be lost forever.
"Raymond, my brother, isn't the man they're all making him out to be."
Her voice was urgent, but not insisting. She seemed to lack the will for that.
"I need someone. Someone people will believe. Let them know what happened to him, how he changed. Why he changed."
"Someone white," I thought, not unkindly. She was right, after all.
"His lawyers at the public defender's office recommended you. They said you had a special kind of concern for people who've used up all their chances."
In unsteady breath, she collected herself.
"Can you help me?"
So that's the word out there, I thought. I'm the new St. Jude. Judas, not Iscariot, in the discriminating words of John the Apostle. Patron saint of the unlucky break. In an earlier, less ambiguous era, the perfect role for Spencer Tracy, Pat O'Brien. I slid my hand inside her arm. "Let's find somewhere to talk, shall we?" 2. All I knew about the case was what I'd read in the local paper and online news, which long experience inclined me to mistrust. Supposedly, Marshalene's brother, Raymond Kersey, served as leader of what was known as a wrecking crew. His two accomplices provided the details of their operation and post-arrest statements they gave once they heard about the killing, at which point they realized that full cooperation provided the only escape from being charged with the felony murder of a peace officer, even though they'd had nothing to do with pulling the trigger. Their involvement in the precipitating crime was enough to condemn them. According to those interviews, which almost immediately found their way to the press, the three men would drive up at dusk in a U-Haul truck to a foreclosed or otherwise vacant property and back into the drive like they belonged there, movers or a salvage crew sent by the owner or the bank. Wearing coveralls and work boots and hard hats with hands-free headlamps attached, hefting shoulder bags heavy with tools, they'd quickly move to the outside conduits, turn off the water at the main, close off the gas, hit the outside kill switch for the electricity. Once that was done, they'd troop around to the backyard, crisscross a door window with duct tape, bust the glass quietly, then reach through, unlock the door, and enter. Alarms, even ones linked to a power bypass, were never an issue. Who ponies up for security on an REO? Once inside, they'd switch on their headlamps like miners entering a galleried shaft and fan out. One would hit the nearest bathroom, flush the john to empty the refill tank, then loosen the lug nuts, fastening it to the floor. If there was a freestanding sink, he'd set to work on that next. The second of the three would check a wall switch just to be sure the current was safely off, then head for the main circuit breaker, sledge a hole in the drywall above the switch panel, pick through the debris, snip the power lines, and begin pulling the wire from the wall. The third would check the attic, locate the lines of copper tubing hooked up to the air conditioner, and go at the soldered joints with a hacksaw. They'd move their booty to the empty garage, used for a staging area for the final loading, then head back to the kitchen, the laundry room, disconnect the stove, the fridge, the washer, the dryer, maybe even the water heater, pull the appliances away from the wall, strap them one by one to a dolly, and wheel them down to add to the rest. Once everything they wanted was in hand, they'd hit the manual override on the garage door, slide it up, pack the truck as fast as they could. Twilight would have given way to darkness by now. Then head for the salvage yard where they unloaded their take and collected their cash. In the span of 6 weeks, they hit 16 houses, gutting them of everything that could be quickly sold off. It was the 17th house where things went wrong. They were at work inside a Monterey-style split level in an upscale, if not exactly Tony neighborhood, known as Hunter's Hill, when a cruiser slowed to a stop at the curb, spotting their headlamps flickering beyond the curtains. They were on the local radar by then, their MO a daily recitation at pre-shift briefings, and the officer who spotted the truck in the drive and the lights within called his watch commander and asked for backup. When the trio slid open the garage door, they were greeted by the distinctive command presence shouts to freeze, hands in the air, punctuated by a few particularly tart obscenities according to some scandalized neighbors. Two of the three burglars obeyed. Raymond Kersey did not. He fled out the back, delivered a forearm shiver to the throat of one of the officers standing there in the yard, stole his weapon, pistol-whipped the second officer, then hurdled the fence and disappeared. Despite dogs on the ground and a helicopter in the air, he remained at large the entire night, a testament to his training as a Marine, his service in Iraq. Come daybreak, he carjacked a Subaru wagon at a stop sign near an industrial park along the river. After dragging the driver out and forcing her at gunpoint to lie flat on the pavement in her yoga pants and Buddha Heart hoodie, he jumped behind the wheel and headed across town for the interstate. The woman flagged down another car quick. The 911 call hit dispatch with a description of the Subaru, and Corporal Kevin Tamburo spotted it heading east toward I-80. Corporal Tamburo hit his strobe and gave chase. Raymond, seeing the cop behind him, turned off the main drag and fled at high speed, plowing through red lights into a rougher neighborhood known as Brickyard, a warren of ramshackle bungalows and shabby duplexes once favored by shipyard and warehouse workers. Tamburo followed, informed by his watch commander that other officers were also now in pursuit. When the as-yet unidentified suspect, black male adult, early 30s, 6 feet or taller, strongly built, armed, and dangerous, turned up into a narrow side street, Tamburo apparently sensed a chance to end the thing. Performing a pit maneuver, he tagged the Subaru's rear fender hard, forcing it to spin out and slam into another car parked at the curb. As Tamburo exited his cruiser, the suspect, Raymond, scrambled from the Subaru and fled toward a nearby backyard. A second black and white, manned by Officer Jesse Unger, pulled up just as Tamburo sprinted around the back of the house where Raymond had just disappeared. Unger recalled hearing three shots, two in quick succession, then a third after a short pause. When he turned the corner, he met a high wooden fence. Peering over, He saw Tamburo face down in the enclosed yard. Unger found a spot he could scramble over easily, jumped the fence, ran to Tamburo's side and found him unresponsive, bleeding profusely beneath his vest. He radioed for an ambulance and attempted CPR. Meanwhile, back on the street, three other officers who'd arrived on scene cornered Raymond as he frantically tried the door handles on cars parked along the street, hoping for one that might be unlocked. He hurried to a nearby porch, pounded on the front door, shouting something no one understood, a fact confirmed by several witnesses, including the homeowner, an elderly woman named Carmela Vines, because what he said seemed to be in a foreign tongue. It was, as translators confirmed after listening to videotapes taken from the nearby squad cars. The language was Arabic. Wena zojik, shufni, shufni. Where is your husband? Show me. Which, even translated, made no sense. Mrs. Vines did not open her door. After numerous shouts to stop and show his hands, Raymond Kersey turned, glanced up into the sky as though to curse the god he didn't find, then lifted his arms above his head and was taken into custody. The arresting officers found the service weapon stolen off the officer at the burglary scene in Raymond's coverall pocket, shell casings found in the backyard where Tamburo was shot, as well as slugs taken from his body, were later positively linked to that weapon. A medevac chopper arrived within minutes and airlifted Tamburo, still bleeding badly and unconscious, to the John Muir Trauma Center. He died en route. 3.
I have to be careful,
Marshalline said, staring into her tea at a cafe far enough away from the courthouse to feel safe.
I can't let people know Raymond's my brother. I still use my ex-husband's name. Easier collecting child support that way. So that's not a problem. But if anyone at the title company suspected Raymond and me were family, just like that. Paycheck, healthcare, gone. Got a girl in middle school. Can't afford that.
The cafe tables were covered in red-checked vinyl. Pots of honey and bottles of Tabasco joined the usual setups of salt, pepper, sugar. Outside the window, sunlight and April conspired in an unnervingly beautiful day.
You didn't do anything, I said.
The title company would risk a wrongful dismissal action, if you were terminated, I mean.
They just say business is down. Necessary cutbacks, you know.
They'd have to prove that. She waved that away like I was talking childishness.
Point is, don't make much difference anyhow. Raymond don't want me showing up in court, talking to the press, standing by him, none of that.
He told you this? She shook her head.
He won't talk to me. Him and me haven't spoke in 4 years.
The waitress came to refill my coffee. I smiled and declined, waiting till she was gone before saying, "What happened?" Marshalline disappeared for a moment behind the veil of her thoughts.
The night Obama was elected, first time I mean, I was all optimistic. I was trying to be positive, you know. I'd seen how Raymond had become. It scared me. In his own world all the time, staring at nothing. Terrible temper when he wasn't just numb. I said, things are gonna change now. You watch.
She nodded at the memory, like she was honoring a promise to tell the truth.
He sat there like he hadn't heard. I was about to say it again, but then he shook his head, wouldn't even look at me. Just kept staring at the TV like he thought it might rise up and fly.
She took a moment, glanced out the window at the bustling street.
Late that night after I went to bed, I heard this odd sound. This kind of crackle and pop and hiss. I went to the window and looked out on the little detached garage behind the house. It was on fire. And Raymond was just standing there, watching.
He's not who they're making him out to be. And you still want to help him? She turned to me with those swallowing eyes.
You read the Bible much, Mr. Tierney?
I worked up a smile. I was raised Catholic, I said. The Bible was considered a secondary source. It was the catechism, not scripture, that got drilled into us. She nodded politely, to convey she understood, perhaps, or just indulge me.
When the Bible was translated into Greek, she said, they had to decide what word to use for sin. The Hebrew word suggested rebellion, against God or a king, or just a turning away from the law. In the Dead Sea Scrolls, the word had a different sense, not so much an individual deed, but a condition, a power over the human race. The opposing power was the Holy Spirit.
She paused to take a sip of her tea, set the cup back down, her movement slow, deliberate, an air of ritual.
The Greek word they used when they translated was amartia. Its original meaning was to miss the mark, because when we sin, we fail to hit the target of our true selves. We go astray or fall short. But it's also the word that they use for tragic flaw in literature. She smiled. My pastor is a great lover of Shakespeare as well as St. Paul.
How scandalously broad-minded, I thought, having the sense not to say it out loud.
My brother sinned, Mr. Tierney.
Her voice took a soft, dark turn.
In some sense, I think he did, yes, rise up against God and the law. He came back from the war so silent and solitary, all clenched up like a fist. Maybe when he was in Iraq, he saw too much of evil's power in this world. Lost faith in the Holy Spirit, I can't say. He never spoke to me about any of that.
That's something I can look into, I said.
I know what he did is a terrible thing. I know the officer he killed was a good man and didn't deserve to die. But I don't see the Holy Spirit at work and all the hatred rising up against him, neither.
I resisted the urge to reach across the table, touch her arm reassuringly, instead saying merely, neither do I.
He's alone. I'm all he's got. Mama died the year before Raymond joined the service. Heart attack, 50 years old. He took that hard. He was Mama's man.
She took a long, slow, ragged breath. Take your time, I said. One of those inane things one utters.
I prefer,
she said, reviving her thought,
to believe Raymond just missed the mark. Strayed from the path that leads back to the brother I know and remember.
I want to know a lot more about all of that, I said, realizing with that statement that I'd put aside any misgivings. I'd agreed. I'd committed. She smiled, a kind of grateful humility in her eyes, and folded her hands as though caressing something very small and fragile, but alive.
I know nobody else wants to hear it, but when I think of who he might have been, the boy he was when we were growing up, the brother I loved and looked up to, all I can say to myself is, yes, it's terrible what's happened. It's unthinkable what he did. But that's the tragedy.
4. You're working for who? Cass stood cross-armed in the kitchen doorway. 6 feet tall, reckless red hair, still in scrubs from her shift at the oncology ward. I'd just told her I'd agreed to work with Raymond Kersey's defense team. She said,
I knew Kevin Tamburo.
You're aware of that, right? You told me, yes. She coached girls' basketball at St. Catherine's. Tamburo had coached the team at Stallworth High, taken them to the sectional finals a few years back. Both did the job for nothing, volunteers.
You know how many girls from his team spoke at his memorial service? You had cops from all over the state, Christ, the country, every politician from 50 miles around, even the governor. Crowd filled the whole gym and spilled out into the hallways. But it was those girls who brought them to tears. They loved him.
Cass,
and you're telling me you're going to help the gutless?
Her voice trailed away. She dropped her eyes. It's what I do, I said. You know that.
This isn't some saggy pants corner clown.
It doesn't matter who it is. We'd been through this before. She wasn't some hard-line fascista who wanted the guilty strung up yesterday, but she did have a low tolerance for those who always seemed to find themselves on the path to pity town, her phrase borrowed from her dad, drumming up excuses for failing rather than reasons to try harder.
Stay here.
She gathered up her car keys.
There's someone I want you to meet.
A half hour later, she returned with a young lady named Anita Ramirez, red jeans and green Keds, a t-shirt under her pullover, black hair scooped back in a majestic ponytail, little silver dolphins dangling from each ear. The three of us pulled up chairs around the kitchen table.
Nita helps me out sometimes at practice when she's free, Cass said. Her sister Carla's on the team. Reason I asked her over? Nita played for Stallworth, year they made it to the finals.
Anita accepted this introduction with a lost smile. She had the kind of face that reminded me of my favorite nuns growing up, the ones who invariably left the convent, too pretty to marry merely the Lord. Nothing showy, just wholesomeness and health and big dark eyes that could melt a heretic's heart. She looked from me to Cass and back again, waiting for a cue. Cass said,
"Just tell him what we talked about in the car."
Anita folded her hands and squared her shoulders.
I don't mean to cause any trouble, she began. I mean, I know you have...
It's okay,
I told her, letting my glance drift to Cass, then back. I know why you're here. Go ahead and tell me. She cleared her throat, collected her thoughts.
Coach Tamburo stepped in my junior year. We didn't have much of a team up to then. Wasn't anybody's fault. We just weren't, you know, very much of anything, really.
We always looked forward to the Stallworth games, Cass said. Easy win.
Yeah,
Anita chuckled.
But then Coach T came in.
Her smile turned winsome.
First day I remember, he just made it crystal clear. Good enough ain't good enough.
Put that on a t-shirt, I thought, or the man's grave.
He told us we were going to start off hating him, some of us were going to quit, and yeah, some did,
Cass said.
Half the team, I heard. Just about. But those who stuck with him, he said, those who had the strength to stay the course, he used that expression a lot. They'd gain a whole new idea of what they could do. The mind and the will are stronger than the body. He said that a lot, too. And look where it took us. I mean, nobody in their wildest dreams thought we'd have a shot at the sectionals, let alone state finals, but we did. And came within a baseline jumper, Cass said, of kicking it into overtime.
But there's more to it than that, I guessed. You're not here just because he taught you the pick and roll.
No.
She tucked an invisible strand of hair behind her ear.
My dad left when I was 8. Hadn't seen him since then. Kind of forgot about him, or at least I thought I had. Senior year, he shows up out of the blue. Wants us all to be one big family again, like nothing ever happened. Oh, he said all the right things and acted all sorry and took the blame, you know, the way guys do when they're not really copy to anything.
I know the type, I said, glancing across the table again toward Cass, the light above the sink glowing behind her like an aura. Maybe too well.
Well, in particular, he makes a big deal about him and me making up for lost time. Everything's going to be different now. He comes to the games, becomes all rah-rah, and it throws me off, you know? Like it just adds more pressure. I blow some easy shots, get into foul trouble because I'm reaching in, not moving my feet.
The burden of perfection. Isn't that what dads are for?
He gets down on me for my play, and I realize then that I'm some kind of meal ticket. He's got high hopes or something. I'm gonna go pro and make millions. And next thing I know, I'm, like, angry all the time except when I'm depressed or scared.
She seemed to vanish into the memory for a second. Cass prompted her with,
"Tell him what Coach T said."
Anita nodded, smiled, scratched at what I suspected was a phantom itch.
Coach T could see something was wrong, but he figured I didn't want to talk about it in front of the team. So he started waiting down the block in his patrol car as I walked to school, picked me up at the corner. We'd go to Starbucks or Scotty's and just talk. Or I'd talk. He'd listen.
That's impressive, I admitted. A man who listens.
Wasn't just me he'd do this with. Vanna and Latrice said he did the same thing with them. Checked in from time to time, asked them how it was going at home, how their studies were doing, what they wanted to do once they graduated. None of us had dads, or not, you know, real ones.
We all, I thought, could use a guardian angel from time to time. How startling it must have felt to actually find one.
It wasn't put on, she said, staring at something 1,000 miles away. He wasn't trying to be a great guy. He just was,
Cass said.
Tell him what he said about your dad. I explained the situation,
Anita said.
He'd noticed I was distracted. I told him about the anger and the depression and being scared, and he said, nothing wrong in being scared. We're all scared all the time.
How true, I thought. How honest of him to admit it. I was ruefully coming to admire the man my client's brother had murdered.
Anita said, he told me about some of the things he faced as a cop. Crazy-ass dogs and guys on PCP, hookers with switchblades. I joked with him when he told me that. Said that's what we should call the team. This housewife with a skillet came up behind him once, broke open his skull when they came to arrest her husband after she was the one called 911 because he was beating on her and getting shot at, spat at, all of it.
Her gaze drifted inward as she remembered the next part.
He said, the day I'm not scared is the day I end up getting killed or get somebody else killed.
Her voice turned shaky and she put her hand to her face. Cass reached over, stroked her back. I felt like a particularly poisonous variety of toad.
He told me there was nothing wrong with how I felt. He said to use the anger. Anger helps us get past the fear. turned the anger into aggression, the aggression into a sense of purpose. When it came to my dad, be clear on what I want, focus on it hard, honor my boundaries, and he'd back me up, no matter what.
Her chest shuddered. She covered her face again.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. She waved her free hand. It's just, you know, it's so hard. I miss him so much.
A few hours later, after Anita had gone, Cass sat up reading in bed, wearing drawstring pajama pants and a Giants t-shirt with the team's name in Spanish across the chest. Gigantes. I slipped off my shoes, got in beside her, pulled her toward me. After a moment, she put her book down, rested her head on my chest. I settled my cheek on her impossible hair. We sat like that, a long time, saying nothing. There was really no need. She worked every day with the sick and the frightened and the dying. We both understood that some things lie beyond explanation. Some things are simply the job. 5. I spent part of the next week filing the paperwork to have myself listed as associate counsel, taking the case pro bono, and made 2 attempts to introduce myself to Raymond Kersey at the Justice Center's pretrial detention facility, where he was being held in isolation for his own safety. Wasted effort. The deputies advised me my client refused any and all visitors. There was little surprise in that, considering what Marshalina told me. His lawyers with the county PD had warned me as well. "We welcome any help we can get," they'd said, sounding even more overwhelmed than usual. "Every time you think this thing couldn't get more impossible, the defendant seems to find a way." So instead of meeting with a man whose sister retained a guarded faith in his decency, I began doing background on his tour in Iraq. That seemed the most promising area of inquiry, given Marshalline's account of how and when he'd strayed from the mark, as she put it. His service record revealed combat duty in Nasiriyah, Al-Gharaf, and the First Battle of Fallujah. From what I'd read of these actions, I had little doubt that they could have easily provided an up-close and personal encounter with hell, even if that wasn't exactly what we'd gone to the cradle of civilization to find. It took a while, but I tracked down his unit and the fire team he'd served with, began trying to find out where I might locate the men. In the meantime, I visited a psych counselor at the VA I knew, a man named Mike Dunleavy, who had special devotion to the men and women who hadn't quite found their way home.
"Re-entry," he said, as I took a seat across from his desk, mounded with its chaos of helter-skelter files. "There's a euphemism for you, or a myth."
He had an ex-smoker's stare and the girth of a merry gourmand. Though he was barely 50, his hair was the tufty white of field cotton, and he sported an equally grand and immaculate beard. Santa in the trenches. He poured coffee from a drip decanter and handed it to me, poured one for himself, then sat. I'd called ahead, so he knew the man I was interested in.
"Don't envy you," he said,
knitting his hands across his midriff, rocking in his chair.
"If anybody knows how easily these guys can trip the wire, it's me, but this..."
"Yeah," I sipped my coffee. It tasted like civilization. "I know."
"Upfront disclaimer, I knew Kevin Tamburo."
He eyed me with wary regret.
"He was a vet as well. Don't know if you were aware of that. The first Iraq fiasco. Nothing like the second go-round, but still..."
This wasn't getting any simpler. "So there's no point seeking your testimony."
"As what? An expert?"
I shrugged.
"If you didn't know Raymond Kersey personally." "I didn't." He lifted his coffee. "He never graced my door."
"Might have been better if he had."
"Agreed. Not uncommon, to be honest. A lot of guys hope it'll all just go away, or feel too ashamed to talk about it."
He drank lustily, then cleared a place for his cup amid the clutter on his desk.
"But that's all academic. Your client never stopped in to begin the process, and a very good man is dead."
I spread my hands to conjure the emptiness in my possession. "Any suggestions?"
"Concerning..."
"Reasons my client went off the rails."
"Assuming, for the sake of argument, that's what occurred."
"Touché." "Yes." He leaned back and examined the ceiling.
"PTSD's losing traction with judges and juries, especially after Chris Kyle's murder."
I was very much aware of that case. Chris Kyle, the most decorated sniper in American history, plus a friend of his named Chad Littlefield, had been gunned down by a fellow Iraq War veteran they were trying to help. The killer claimed in his defense he'd been psychotic. As proof, he offered his history of treatment by the VA. During victim impact statements, Littlefield's brother spoke directly to the accused. "Your claims of PTSD have been an insult to every veteran who served with honor, disgracing a proud military with your cowardice. I didn't expect a terribly different reaction if I tried a similar approach, and yet here I was." Mike said, "People think they've heard it all before, which of course is a crock, but people believe what they want. If it isn't new, it can't be true." "A lot of that going around," I said. "You're right." He made a sound a Victorian would have called a harumph, then idly brushed something off his chair arm, thinking, "Maybe it's not such a bad thing, turning that narrative on its head." I caught the change in tone. "Yearning for the days of battle fatigue and soldier's heart? Or shell shock. You know the George Carlin routine, I assume." He meant the bit where the comedian tracks the evolution of the terminology and observes that the more conspicuous the psychobabble, post-traumatic stress disorder, for example, the more obvious the bureaucracy's hand in denial and cover-up. "I do. Just like everybody else of a certain age. It's almost as famous as 7 dirty words, the ones you can't say on TV.
"Words are important."
He sat back, locked his hands musingly behind his neck.
"The media, for example, loves the phrase ticking time bomb. Helps them promote the idea of the dangerous vet. Blackouts, flashbacks, night terrors, or just good old-fashioned running amok. Some guys won't even mention their service in job interviews out of fear they'll be seen as a hopeless loose cannon."
I checked that off mentally. Find out how many times Raymond had gone on job interviews, how many times he'd been turned away.
"Truth is," Mike said, "violence by vets is pretty damn rare. A lot like shark attacks, relatively uncommon. But tell that to Mrs. Mom watching Susiekin splashing around out there in the surf. Your chances of being bitten by another human being in New York are 10 times greater than being bitten by a shark worldwide." A relatively useless statistic on my end, I thought. The shark had already struck. Mike stroked his woolly beard.
"So you need something people won't just tune out automatically. Something novel, but not, well, flighty."
That indeed resembled the port in the storm I hoped for. "Credibility's a plus, yeah." A wise smile. He nodded.
"Are you aware of the term moral injury?"
With a shrug, I admitted I wasn't.
"Pentagon isn't keen on admitting it exists. They tend to disdain any suggestion that combat might offend the conscience."
"Because we're the good guys."
"Bingo, as Hippocrates was fond of saying. Don't get me wrong, the men and women I see deserve the word good, if anyone on the planet does."
"Agreed," I said, not just for the sake of argument.
"PTSD's etiology is rooted in high sustained fear, specifically a prolonged or catastrophic exposure to life threat. It's distinguished by 3 distinct behavioral clusters: hyperarousal, intrusive memories, and strategic avoidance of circumstances that suggest the trauma, often characterized by numbing. The problems arise when the avoidance prevents emotional accommodation of the trauma, which exacerbates the intrusive memories. Then you're caught in this hellish loop of going numb, then having your nightmares snap you back."
I remembered Marshalline's description of her brother as, among other things, cycling between angry and numb. Would coming here to seek treatment, seeing all the other vets and what they're going through, be one of those circumstances that suggests the original trauma?
"Of course," Mike said. "But the simple reality of other people, the potential for caring about somebody else or being cared for, can suggest the trauma as well."
"Jesus."
"Let me finish my thought."
"Sorry."
"Moral injury, in contrast to PTSD, usually only presents as intrusion and avoidance, not hypervigilance. That's because it doesn't result from fear. It comes from witnessing or perpetrating or simply being part of what the individual considers an atrocity."
"The tree of knowledge," I thought. "It's poisonous fruit. Can you give me any examples?"
"Your unit's taking fire from a house across the square, so you light it up. Except the enemy has a family inside, using them as human shields.
When you walk through the wreckage, you find them all dead. You killed them.
Okay.
Sometimes it's as simple a thing as seeing dead bodies for the first time, especially women, kids. That's the problem with counterinsurgency. The battle space has no boundaries. Who exactly is the enemy? Some youngster you've been dealing with for weeks, to the point he's kind of a squad mascot, suddenly pitches a frag grenade inside your Hummer. Or he's there by the side of the road thumbing a cell phone when an IED goes off. That's common? Only has to happen once to mess with your head.
I get that.
Your buddy died, and you think it's your fault. That's the worst. That can last a lifetime.
Usually does. I made a mental note to check to see if anyone in Raymond's unit died in combat.
I've talked to guys who couldn't forgive themselves for dragging families out of their homes in the middle of the night and forcing them to lie in the dirt while their unit ransacked the place for weapons. Good men don't like playing bully. It gets worse if you find out your squaddies are stealing stuff as they search inside.
A shrug. Soldiers like their mementos. Better than taking scalps, I suppose.
This may sound naive, I said, but isn't that just war?
It's the media's idea of war, Hollywood's idea. The military takes a lot of pride in training warriors, not criminals. Military culture relies on honor, loyalty, discipline, obedience, selflessness.
I said, ideals are a lot easier to list than live up to.
Especially if you think you're beginning to lose.
Meaning?
The side that sees itself as weaker or fears it's facing defeat tends to pull out all the stops. There's no honor in losing. That's when sheer malice takes over. Or evil, if you don't find that term overly quaint.
I would think getting shot at would be enough to trigger that.
Actually, confusion usually comes first. A lot of guys, when they first come under fire, are baffled. Why is that guy shooting at me? What did I ever do to him? Seriously. Then one of your friends takes a round, and it becomes very real very quick. The other side isn't just the other side anymore. They're the enemy, and you experience what is sometimes poetically referred to as the wind of hate.
Now, there was an angle I'd insufficiently considered, the poetry. Again, I said, sorry if I'm a little behind the curve here, but in every war, one side sooner or later begins to see they're losing, or at least not winning, and that's when, from what you're saying, things go rogue. So, isn't what you're talking about normal?
Mike laced his hands across his midriff again, a philosophical sigh.
I would differentiate common from normal.
And in the law, I thought, we call that a distinction without a difference.
The point I'm trying to make, he said, is that to understand moral injury, you have to put yourself in the shoes of someone who went over there with basic assumptions that the world is meaningful, the self is worthy. Then, something happens. Something so horrific and pointless and wrong, something so offensive to your conscience, so contrary to your idea of what life is about, that your deepest sense of who you are and what it means to live your life is shattered. Things turn dark and stay that way. The rules of gravity no longer apply. Nothing feels true. You lose faith in the people you're there to help, the mission, your commanders, your country, the folks back home you went there to protect, human nature in general.
Yourself, I guessed. It's a very subjective thing. Everybody's moral tripwire is set differently.
Not surprisingly, the best indicator of how you do long-term is whatever meaning you can credibly give to what happened, the context you can create.
War is hell.
I did my job.
A corporal bearing files appeared at the door, prepared to knock, then caught the mood between Mike and me. Nodding politely, he said, I'll come back.
Not to be glib, I said once he was gone, but what you're describing, understanding the context, looking for meaning, that's pretty much how people make sense of civilian life, too. When it goes haywire, I mean. Death of a child, that kind of thing.
My point, he said, is that the guys who come back and get into crime are more often dealing with moral injury than PTSD. If fear's a problem, it's not what's troubling them most. Guilt and shame are.
I realized, finally, the lesson's takeaway.
Given time, he said, the guilt you can usually deal with.
You did a bad thing, but you're not a bad person. You can be forgiven. Shame's the bear. You've seen something or done something that makes you feel hideous, contaminated, unforgivable.
A monster, I thought. The thoughtful young man who becomes a Marine, the Marine who morphs into a careless killer, the killer who murders a cop.
You come back to a world you no longer recognize, he said. Christ, you no longer recognize yourself. You have thoughts you'd rather die than share. And you're supposed to act like it's all copacetic. Kiss the wife, snuggle the baby. You left the bad stuff behind. Except the bad stuff's inside. It's you.
So what's the solution?
Good news? There's such a thing as moral repair. Bad news, we're nowhere close to understanding it. Not like with PTSD. There's no universally accepted treatment regimen, no medication. As I mentioned, the DOD's not much help, not yet. They prefer the term adjustment reaction.
I saw a faint glimmer of hope, an argument I could hang my hat on. Even if Raymond had sought treatment, there was arguably nothing to find. Thanks for this, Mike, I owe you. I got up to leave, buttoned my sport coat. One last question. How does one medicate a conscience?
6. I stopped at the Justice Center and tried again to visit with Raymond, only to learn he continued to take the term isolation aggressively to heart. Rather than waste the trip, I asked to see another client in pre-trial detention, a young man named Armando Belasco. Armando, youngest son from a wealthy third-generation Guatemalan clan, had been arrested impersonating a Mayan priestess, a Bruja Blanca, offering to spiritually purify homes throughout the Napa Valley. Dressed in a white ceremonial robe and using incense made of myrrh, sage, and copal, he, which is to say, she, Mariana Palacios was the name on the business card, blessed the various rooms of the house, murmuring incantations and chasing away curses, bad habits, lousy luck. Unfortunately, a 16-year-old boy in Yountville admitted to letting the Bruja exorcise more than his troubling dreams. I waited alone in the general visiting area as the guards collected Armando from his tier, musing on the wind of hate as I glanced up at the unforgiving light cast down by the caged high-wattage bulbs in the ceiling. A toxic toddler stench of diapers lingered, tinged with a whiff of mildew from the chugging Coke machine. Finally, one of the guards appeared and took me back to the smaller room reserved for attorney visits. Armando sat waiting in his orange jumpsuit, white t-shirt and socks, rubber flip-flops. Rocking nervously in the plastic chair, he folded in on himself, leaning toward the table, hands restless like moths, touching his chin, his shoulder, his ear. He'd been transferred here from the county lockup. Pre-trial motions were due on Monday. I'd come to deliver an update and collect names of additional character witnesses, anyone Armando could think of. He provided some names. I wrote them down.
The lawyer says it's, like, impossible to get ready for a trial.
His whisper seemed less a voice than the memory of one.
He can't get nothing from the police. They've, like, cut staff so bad nobody answers the phone. He can't even get an appointment to look at my evidence, you know? Said it's like a ghost town over there.
I imagined from the perspective of jail, the whole outside world could feel like that. I'll have a talk with him, I said. Though I was technically a lawyer as well, I was working solely as an investigator in this case, my other hat. He can't just call the police and expect anything. You have to show up, annoy them till they can't ignore you anymore. Armando nodded, then glanced up, eyes dull with a weariness of dread.
You said Mrs. Hernandez changed her mind?
Mrs. Hernandez was the mother of the teenage boy that Armando, in his Bruja Blanca robe, with sage and myrrh and copal incense burning in the room, had violated, molested, fellated. Last time we spoke, yeah. I managed to get her to talk to me. Both she and Stevie were feeling a little sheepish about the whole thing. She's not going to drop charges, but she's willing to admit at sentencing that her son is more embarrassed than traumatized. Armando, apparently, was a very convincing woman. But the dad's just one of those men, old-school macho, you know the breed.
Yes.
Armando nodded like a spooked colt.
Only too well.
He may bully them into wanting blood, but if they go that route, we can use what they told me during Cross. If they perjure themselves, I'll testify.
Thank you, he whispered, for everything.
At the time of Armando's arrest, his hair had been shoulder length, his nails long and tapered. Fearing what might happen to him inside, he'd cut his nails to the quick and shorn his hair to stubble. His face looked gaunt, not finely boned, but part of that was because he'd lost 15 pounds, thinking, who punks a skeleton? I tried to tell him his fears were baseless. You could always buy sex behind bars, so only an utter bonehead would risk months in isolation for a needless rape. But some myths die hard. Armando remained convinced he'd been spared because of how utterly undesirable he was as a man. All of which, for whatever reason, conjured an image of Raymond wandering the battle space, which, I supposed, was just another kind of prison. A Holocaust cityscape sculpted in ruin, where the harmless and helpful turn around and betray you, kill you, the soul-destroying savagery you witness, or perpetrate. I wondered if, in the regimented to and from inside the jail, Raymond and Armando had crossed paths, exchanged a glance, or even locked eyes, if only for a moment. What unspoken knowledge would pass between them? What might the killer tell the witch? I pushed back my chair. Try not to be so afraid, I thought, knowing better than to say it so plainly. I extended my hand. Hang in there. Armando bucked up a smile.
Yes, you always say that.
I was heading for my car in the parking lot. Late afternoon sky, sun setting far beyond an incoming storm, colors like some fever dream cocktail, when someone called my name. Turning, I saw a thin, sandy-haired man in a dark suit crossing the pavement toward me. I recognized him even from that distance. Jordan Skellinger, a detective with the Rio Morada police. We'd met the year before when both of us, in our separate ways, tried to help a girl named Jacqueline Garza. Neither of us had done our best, I suppose, but after a couple of terrible turns, things did in fact come out okay. Jackie now lived around the corner from Cass and me. She spent a lot of time at the house, often staying over when she felt a bad night coming on, which happened a lot, often enough. Skellinger stopped about 2 yards away, pushed back his coattails, rested his hands on his narrow hips. His badge showed on his belt.
You're working for the shithole who killed Kev Tamburo.
Word gets around, I thought. Raymond Kersey, yeah, I was hired by his sister. Skellinger nodded like his mind was filled with things to say. Too many things.
Frankly, I'd expected more out of you.
Ah, this. You know how things work, Jordy. Come on.
Yeah.
He crossed his arms and waited for a heavy-set woman pushing a stroller to pass out of earshot along the line of parked cars. Wind mussed his neatly combed hair.
Know what else I know? The discovery requests the rest of your team have made? It's obvious where they're going with this.
I'm not part of that, I said. I'm only working sentencing phase.
Sentencing? Why not let the scum fuck die the way Kev did?
Jordy?
You know his shoulder mic was on when he was shot, right?
Inwardly, I cringed. How much worse could this thing get?
Seriously, when Kev jumped the fence, he got hung up by his duty belt. He's hanging there, trying to get free when your lovely client takes his first 2 shots. Target practice. But then there's a pause, in the shots, I mean. You listen to the tapes. You can still hear Kev. Ever hear a man as he takes 2 bullets, one in the neck? Don't worry, you'll get your chance. Meanwhile, your boyfriend waltzes up, shoves the 9 up under Kev's vest. Know what he says?
No, I said. Skellinger leaned in to whisper,
call the law.
He leaned back, let that sink in.
Then Judge Jumpsuit pulled the trigger one last time.
I remembered the news accounts of the shooting, the 2 quick shots followed by a pause before the 3rd. Jordy, there's a difference between trying to understand what happened and wanting to justify it.
From where I stand, that's a pretty good definition of chicken shit.
I almost said, have it your way. But I knew this was a good man. Like I said, I'm not working guilt phase. My focus is sentencing.
Don't think for a minute that lets you off the hook.
Jordy,
you know what they're gonna say at trial, right?
that Kev fucked up. Like it's his own damn fault your shitbird client took him out.
I don't know how else to say it. That's not...
Know the two most dangerous years for a cop? First and last. First year because you don't know anything. Last year because you think you know it all. You get careless. And yeah, Kev was 20 years in, fully vested, and they're gonna make it out like he got sloppy. Maybe he did. You could say that, I suppose. But you had to know the man. You have to think like he did. Sure, he should have waited for backup before leaving his car. Sure, he never should have chased the asshole on foot alone. Sure as hell never tried to jump a fence blind. But you know what? That wasn't stupidity or arrogance on Kev's part. He knew how undermanned we are. Knew the guy was armed. If that asshole got inside one of those houses, took hostages, a standoff was the best you could hope for. He doesn't charge hard. Somebody was gonna get hurt, no question.
I said, what he did was heroic.
Don't you dare use that fucking word.
Like I'd cracked a bad joke.
He wasn't playing hero, he was a damn hero.
That's what I said, I thought, but I knew better than to go there. He wasn't arguing just with me.
You want an idea of what kind of man Kevin was? 18 months ago, his two best friends, husband and wife, died in a car wreck. Went off the road in a freak storm up in the Sierras. They had two teenage girls, couple years apart. Kev and Judy not only took those girls in, Kev built an addition to the house just for them. Did the job himself, whole nine yard, carpentry, plumbing, painting, shingling the roof, his own damn hands. Do you see where the fuck I'm going with this?
His voice echoed across the asphalt in the gusty twilight. 2 miles over, heads turned. I do, I said. I'm not doing this because I'm unaware of who Kevin Tamburo was, or because I think anything less than justice is called for. He dropped his head, let out a thin, trembling laugh, quietly.
How can you do what you do?
I'm a mutant from the planet Lawyer.
Listen. I don't mean to be smug or self-righteous. I'm not calling you out. I'm just baffled. I swear to God, I couldn't do it. Just couldn't.
I didn't know what to say. He seemed to gather himself, running his hand through his sand-brown hair, shaking his head as though continuing some inner tirade. After a moment, plucking the thought from midair, he said,
"How's Jackie doing?"
Not looking at me, voice tight, under control.
"She's good," I said, knowing what, in his own way, he was getting at.
I'd taken in a troubled teen as well. He knew I wasn't Satan in a suit. That's what was driving him nuts. Not exactly sailing through life. She has her rough spots, but the problems she has these days seem like small potatoes compared to what she was dealing with before. Thanks to you as well as me, I almost added, but I knew I'd made my point. Nothing to gain by pouring gravy over it. He nodded, chewed his lip. Turning to leave, he looked off toward the surreal sunset, still unable or unwilling to meet my eye.
Tell her I said hello.
7. 2 days later, the paper ran a front-page feature on a local probate judge named Denard Rohrbaugh. He'd served in the Adjutant General Corps, Operation Iraqi Freedom, but hadn't sat at a desk in some fortified office, safely tucked away beyond concrete Alaska barriers in Baghdad's green zone. Twice his field quarters got hit, once by a car bomb, once a walk-up wearing a vest, and he'd received a Purple Heart for his injuries and a Bronze Star for the effort he put into digging others out of the wreckage while insurgent snipers took their shots, trying to pin the rescuers down. Judge Rohrbaugh was 33 years of age, a mere 2 years older than Raymond Kersey. Both men were homegrown and black. The message, though unstated, was clear. Regardless of what perils or horrors you endure, you have a choice. That choice emerges from your character. Whatever caused one man to kill a cop, don't blame the war. It seemed obvious that word had leaked out concerning my visit to Mike Dunleavy at the VA. I doubted Mike was the culprit, but that seemed largely irrelevant. The story, though local, would spread via newswire and internet to every jury pool in the state, rendering a change of venue meaningless. And unless Raymond had endured something unspeakably horrible, his war record would be held up against that of the good judge, this brave and honorable man who shed blood for his kin and country. With that, everyone could make up their own minds, if they hadn't already. Two of the five men in Raymond's fire team, the men who would know him best, had re-upped and were redeployed to the Middle East. One was dead. The last was stateside, and by an entirely unexpected stroke of luck, not too far away. His name was Joseph Morales, and he worked as a critical care nurse in the burn unit at the UC San Diego Medical Center. The following morning, I took the earliest flight I could. Renting a Nissan Altima and relying on an utterly unreliable GPS, the voice misdirecting me sounded like a kittenish London shop girl, I eventually muddled my way to the Hillcrest neighborhood and the UCSD Med Center's main campus. I'd not called ahead this time, fearing my chance at an interview could end with a mere click. Always harder to turn away a man who's come a long distance to see no one but you, especially if he's standing right there, asking for your help. I went to the burn unit's nursing station and learned I'd not been too reckless charging down on such short notice. Joe Morales was scheduled for the afternoon shift and would come on duty at 3. I spent the intervening hours in the cafeteria writing reports, reviewing pre-trial motions, and doing research on the net. Come 3 o'clock, I ambled back to the burn unit, which I found a great deal more active than earlier. Patients, young and not so young, bearing their distinctive mottling of skin, the shorn skulls, the disfigured eyelids and ears, shuffled to and fro, garbed in bathrobes, prodded along by the upbeat patter from a nursing aide or family member. One girl, wearing a flower print muumuu, her face masked in bandages, wandered the hall with crayons and coloring book, avoiding the sunnier side of the ward as she looked for somewhere to sit. I quickly recognized my man behind the nursing station desk from nothing more than a premonition. He'd let his hair grow out, no more high-and-tight Marine Corps burr, but his muscular arms were sleeved in tats, and his movements had a clip deficiency. Even so, there was something gentle, almost priestly to his bearing as well, a trait his rimless specs accentuated. Joseph Morales? He glanced up, tossing one patient chart aside as he promptly picked up another. My name is Phelan Tierney. I've been hired by Marshalene Whalen, who's the sister of someone I believe you know. You served with him in Iraq. Raymond Kersey. There's always that first uneasy moment of recognition when the seriousness of what I represent, what I've brought to this person's doorstep, registers. And the sheer volume of the bother it will likely entail, the expenditure of time and patience, the likely heartache, the inevitable anger, the days of indecision, the nights of no sleep. However vaguely all of that takes shape in the mind, fighting with simple curiosity, the desire to find out what this is all about, why I'm there. The young man leaned back in his chair, eyeing me like a puzzle.
Raymond, he said. We called him Wapa. You know, like Burger King? Because he always wanted it his way.
Not an auspicious start. I wonder if you've heard...
I read about it, yeah. And I got a call from one of the other guys in the unit, Leatherneck Grapevine.
I made a mental note. Follow up. Find out who made that call. I wish I had better news to convey.
You didn't come here to bring me the news.
No. He studied me, his eyes seeming a little less gentle now. But then something turned. His expression and posture softened. He said,
I don't get off till 11.
I can handle that, I said. Meet here? He drifted away, came back.
Cafeteria's better. That okay?
I smiled. My wife's a nurse, oncology. Hospital cafeteria's like home away from home.
Okay, then.
He returned to reviewing his patient's charts, as though I'd already vanished. 8 hours later in the cafeteria, 11 o'clock came and went with no appearance from the witness. Disappointing, but not exactly a surprise. Given time to reconsider, just about anyone will see his second thoughts ballooning into doubts, his doubts solidifying into a change of heart. At 15 past, I thought about heading back to the burn unit, but decided to give it another 15 minutes. He showed up within 10. A blue windbreaker over his scrubs, a beat-up leather valise hitched over his shoulder.
Sorry, he said, pulling up a chair. We had a new admission, a kid. First night's always hard.
I asked if you wanted something. Coffee, tea.
No, thanks. I'd like to wrap this up quick if we could. I'm assuming you've already talked to Whopper.
Actually, no. He refuses all visitors, including not just his legal team, but his sister. Morales took that in.
He hadn't as yet taken off his jacket.
Yeah, I kind of figures.
Because... He settled in, dealt with the windbreaker, then rested his arms on the table, folding his hands.
What I'm about to tell you isn't easy to talk about, okay? For any of us. Not with civilians. That's just how it is.
I told him about my visit with Mike Dunleavy, the tutorial I'd received, letting him know that, though I couldn't claim direct experience, I wasn't wholly ignorant either.
Okay,
he said, mollified, if not exactly impressed.
I've thought about this, not just today after you showed up, but ever since I learned what happened, trying to figure out why Wapa took out a cop. And I keep coming back to three incidents, things that happened during our tour together that, from what I can tell, outside looking in, pretty much peeled him raw.
Spoken, I thought, like a man who looks after skin grafts.
Okay, I said.
Let's take them one at a time.
8. We'd been in country less than 48 hours, rolling up from Kuwait, when we caught sight of what looked like some kind of procession along this raised earthwork maybe 2 clicks ahead. We stopped, studied them through our NVGs, night vision goggles. They were just silhouettes from that range, a couple dozen men backlit by oil fires in the distance, but it didn't take much of a guess to figure out they were Iraqi deserters. We'd heard some were already massing and on the move. Wapra and me are both jammed in back of the Humvee, jackknifed in with all the gear. Gunny Connor, the fireteam leader, he's in front with Jake Fraley, who's driving, this bandolier of M203 grenades swaying from the visor rod over his head like some kind of rosary. Jimbo Mobley's manning the grenade launcher, an MK-19 up top, and his knees are like, even with my jaw, I can literally, no joke, taste his farts. I stopped him.
Mobley, he's the one who died.
Morales nodded. In Fallujah, yeah.
I made a mental note.
Okay, just checking. Excuse the interruption. No problem.
Where? You're crammed inside the Humvee, deserters in the distance?
Right, yeah. We're all wearing these clammy, itchy mop suits in case of chemical attack. I mean, we're in the middle of the goddamn desert, right? But these things are dark green, like we've been deployed to the Rhine. There were 1,000 foul-ups like that every day. First thing to remember in all of this, half the time, nothing made sense.
Like the chemical weapons themselves, I thought, are casus belli, which didn't exist.
Anyway, Gunny radios in, tells the other team leaders and the platoon command what we see. Then we just sit there, watching, waiting the rest of the night. The sky's this eerie orange color, like some sci-fi nightmare from the fires and all the dust. As if that's not bad enough, at some point it starts to rain, and it's this swirling, wind-blown muck. The drops are gluey and brown and big as eggs. And even with that, once it passes, there's fucking dust everywhere. Around daybreak, the whole platoon shown up, and the squad leaders put their heads together, decide what to do. We rev up the Hummers and move in. The Iraqis are wearing this mishmash of uniforms and civilian clothes and traditional robes. Some have rags on their feet. They've ditched most of their gear, and you can see it littering the desert for miles. They're starving, dehydrated. Only water they've got is whatever remains in these antifreeze jugs some of them have dragged all the way from Basra. Most are sick, too. Dysentery, you name it, infections, bloody sinuses from the dust kicked up by the winds. They're called shamals, the winds, I mean. They're like notorious that time of year. A few of the prisoners have these day-glow handbills that coalition drones dropped before the invasion, advising the Iraqi troops to surrender, promising humane treatment. A couple others have the tiny Tabasco bottles that come in MREs, meaning they've already encountered American troops somewhere. I don't know how long they'd walked, but they could barely stand now, not just exhausted, but terrified, hacking up blood. Swear to God, the wind, the dust, it's fucking evil. Not just to them. We're all, like, coughing up these chunky yellow clots of pus and phlegm we called the Kuwaiti crud. Lungs feel like you're inhaling razor blades. We corral the prisoners, keep our weapons ready just in case something goes haywire, then hand out water and humrats, humanitarian rations. They come in these real distinctive yellow bags. Didn't learn till later they were bombs out there in the battle space, painted the exact same yellow. The color was meant to ward people off, but kids especially didn't know the difference. There's another of those little foul-ups I told you about. Stuff like that messed with your head every minute of every goddamn day.
Same time we're passing out the water and rations, a corpsman's going round, tending to the prisoners who look the worst, and the platoon terps questioning some of the others. Where do they come from? Where are they headed? That sort of thing. He's this college kid, the interpreter. A Kuwaiti who was studying party psi at Bowling Green till the family pulled the plug. He figured signing up might get him money so he could go back, get a degree. Name was Akbar. He's kind of on the chubby side, so we called him Snack Bar. He's going around to these deserters, chatting them up, wearing Chuck Taylor high tops, Oakley wraparounds, Old Navy cargo pants. He's got a Def Leppard t-shirt, the Results May Vary tour, beneath his regulation khaki blouse. And these prisoners are looking at him like he's everything they want to be. But you can tell from his expression he's not liking what he's hearing. He goes over, connects with the squad and team leaders and the platoon leader, Captain Echevarria. We called him Captain Crack. He talked so fast. Snackbar tells them the prisoners are saying that if they go back the way they came, they'll be killed by Fedayeen. Now, Wampa, he's still kind of full of himself at this point. Cracking jokes are just jawbone in a way. That was his bit. We all did stuff to break the monotony. Anyway, he's listening in on Snackbar's intel and says, you know, all Eddie Murphy. Who's Fat Irene? Gunny shoots him this look, not entirely humorless. Says, Fedayeen, numbnuts. Irregulars, Baathists, loyal to Saddam. Wapa rogers that, and you can see his face change. Suddenly, it's not so comical anymore. He says, call them what they are, Gunny, fucking death squads. We'd talked about this, Wapa and me. My family's from El Salvador. My uncle used to tell me stories about the Civil War. You'd walk out of your house in the morning and stumble over a body. No head or hands. A haircut and a manicure, they called it. And I look at Wampa, try to meet his eyes, but he just pulls his bandana up over his nose and looks away. The captain re-huddles with his NCOs and Gunny, who's senior team leader, gets on the radio, fills in the company commander, who's somewhere to the rear. Meanwhile, the Hajis are sitting in the mud left over from the rain the night before and staring us down, hoping for some sign of that good old-fashioned American decency, you know? They're not fools. You can sense it in the air. This isn't trending well. The platoon's barely got enough water for itself. And we're in a race for relevance, as the captain liked to say. We stop now to process prisoners. We'll be out of the fight. I look over at Wapper and he's like a million miles away. Later on, I find out he's thinking about what the captain said before we rolled out of Kuwait. Perched on the hood of his Humvee, hands clasped behind his back, pulling a full Patton. America's a great country, he said. We're a generous people, fair, trusting. But you're here to hunt. Think like a killer, not a friend. Be bold, trust no one, fear nothing. Act like you're already dead. It just might save you. I mean, you hear that crap all through basic. It's in one ear most times and out the other, until it sticks. And right before battle, it sticks. And you're thinking, okay, right, it's time to be a killer. You wrap your mind around that, and it's all well and good when the man you intend to kill has exactly the same intent. But these men want to surrender. They're doing exactly what we told them to do, give up. And now? Morales paused for a moment, tapping his thumbs together pensively. I could sense he didn't need a prompt. I didn't need to fill the silence. What I needed to do was wait. Gunny finally gets off the horn. He marches back from his Humvee, and, you know, from his face alone, we can tell he's got no good news. I liked Gunny. We all did. Admired him, to be honest. He taught us that pain's an illusion, an imaginary wall created by animal fear to fool us into thinking we have fixed limitations outside the mind. Pain's just there to betray you, he said. And know what? More times than not, I found that to be true, even with the patients I work with now. Anyway, Gunny goes up to the captain and all hush-hush passes along the company commander's order. Captain waves Snackbar over, nods toward the Hajis. Tell them they have to turn around, head back to Basra. Snackbar's like, whoa, me? They'll be killed, he says. Some of these guys already watched their buddies get snuffed by Fedayeen. They want to go to Nasiriyah. Too bad, the captain says. That's where we're heading. Snackbar looks over his shoulder at the prisoners, and they're all taking this in, got their funeral faces on. Snackbar turns back to the captain. They can't, you know, like, straggle behind or something? Captain looks at him like something's just popped out of his neck.
Negative, he says. We're heading into a firefight. No unfriendlies to the rear. Or maybe you'd like to play tour guide. Stay behind with them. Take your chances. Snackbar's having none of that, obviously, so he does as he's told. 5 minutes later, we're watching the deserters rise to their feet, one or two crying out in Arabic. Only word I caught was mort, death, but the rest just turned away, staggering east like they didn't even have the energy to hate us. Comes time to saddle up, head out for Nasiriyah. Wapa's just standing there, watching those men vanish. Mind you, up to this moment, this guy's been class clown. Calls me Mo Alice instead of Morales. Got a joke for damn near everything. Now he's, like, turned to stone. I go up, tell him, hey, come on, Wap, we're moving out. He just stands there. I tell him again, come on, grab his sleeve. He shakes me off, still staring at the poor sucker straggling back to Basra. We both know what we've just done. Finally, in this voice I almost don't recognize, he whispers, like Captain Crack says, we're already dead. 9. I wondered if he'd want to take a moment, gather himself, finally accept some tea or a soda, but he just plowed ahead. The rest of that morning we advance, if that's the word, toward Nasiriyah. Worse than the Tijuana crossing at rush hour, the traffic. 2nd Marine Expeditionary had fought their way through the town the day before, and we all get treated up close and personal to the carnage. There's an Amtrak, charred black, its top peeled back like a blister, resting in the middle of the street they called Ambush Alley. Ponchos cover the bodies of dead Marines, and severed limbs are piled like so much meat on a tarp draped across the hood of a hardback Humvee. They've stationed a single Marine there to ward off the flies and birds. During the fight the day before, the Fedayeen had used women and children as human shields, and 2 civilian buses had disgorged a couple dozen Iraqi fighters, all gunned down by the 2nd Light Armor Regiment. So there were plenty of Iraqi dead to look at as well. We passed this pickup truck with an AA gun bolted into the truck bed, windshield shot to hell, the driver hanging out the cab like a hunter left him half-dressed. Others are just lying around in doorways or right there on the road. Mostly men, but women and kids, too. And these yellow-eyed dogs are skulking everywhere, hoping to feed off the bodies. Light artillery's laying down covering fire as finally we push across the Saddam Canal Bridge. Again, the sand blowing goddamn everywhere, and we're in what looks like a mile-long line of AAVs and Hummers. The suicide train, we call it. That, or just a lot of ass. While an A-10 Warthog howls real low overhead to take out a BM-21 rocket launcher up the road. Once we get free of the in-town clusterfuck, the whole RCT, Regimental Combat Team, is finally rolling forward on Highway 7, one long convoy pressing north for Al-Qut. Had no idea it'd take 10 more days to cover those 200 clicks. Whopper and me, we're crammed in back of the Humvee again, riding with sand goggles on. I even had this medical sling wrapped around my face to keep out the dust. We've both got a single earplug in, right side, the shooting ear. It lends this vaguely underwater feel to things, a whooshing hiss inside your head. That and the drone of the Hummer's diesel almost lulls you to sleep. Up front, Fraley's driving with his M16 perched between his knees, one hand gripping the wheel, the other fine-tuning his radio dials as he tracks tacnets. Gunny's beside him, poring over a map. After what we saw of Nasiriyah, nobody wants to get lost in Al-Gharaf. Meanwhile, up top, Mobley's at the MK-19 slapping out this rhythm on the roof, kinda bump-diddy-pat-pat-taradiddle, and he's bellowing out his battle anthem, this song by Outkast. Just grab my gun and let's go out, grab my gun and let's go out. Usually this is where Whopper would chime in, give the answering verse, or up the ante with a better tune. But now he just sits there, stone quiet. I'm thinking he's still mulling over what happened to those deserters we cut loose. Maybe he was just surrendering to the general mood. We were all quiet. No jokes about blowing ballast or combat jacks, masturbation jags brought on by the tension. No bitching about the superior officers, who we all considered insane, incompetent, or criminally misguided. The prospect of finally some honest-to-God hostility had everybody prepping the mental battle space, picturing possible scenarios, wondering how we'd do.
The radio traffic is stitching together bits of rumor with combat reports, and we're getting a vivid picture of Fedayeen battle tactics. As the day goes on, we begin to realize that if an entire village comes out in waves, the Fedayeen are gone. If nobody steps out in the open, the fuckers could be anywhere. And if a small cluster of villagers approaches the convoy waving like robots, you can bet your life at least one of them has a gun, and he's using the others as camouflage. They just didn't care how many civilians died. If we lit them up, it'd make the news around the world, and that would pass for victory on their end. Meanwhile, up top, Mobley's still singing, going it alone, howling into the dust and wind. Call the law and hold the applause. Call the law and hold the applause. My skin pricked. I thought about stopping him just to confirm the lyric, ask about the song. But I feared if I interrupted, he might decide not to go on. So I lodged it away, the echo in those words, remembering what Skellinger had said, the thing Raymond whispered to Kevin Tamburo just before he pulled the trigger that third and final time. A buck-up anthem as you roll into battle. The last thing you say to a lawman you're about to kill. The desert's flat and bleak at this point, except for the dikes and irrigation ditches crisscrossing the empty fields. Only thing relieving the landscapes, the debris that the aircraft sweeps and artillery strikes have left behind. Sandbags, blown to scrap, smoldering technicals, these pickups with machine guns or AA batteries mounted in the truck beds, the occasional flaming Lion of Babylon, this Iraqi tank patched together from Polish or Russian parts. Never, not once, did we spot a single live soldier on that road. There were a lot of dead ones, though. Some with RPG tubes lying just beyond their reach. Thing I remember most, the whole convoy slowed down for this, so we all got a good look, including Whopper. There's this Haji, with his head snapped back from gun blast, sitting at the wheel of an orange Toyota, its windshield wipers still swishing back and forth. A spider's already made a web between the windshield and his face. Other cars are all blown to hell by warthog cannon fire, the passengers dead in the road. Bodies dotted a field just beyond a shot-up bus, like everyone had fled thinking the open fields were safer somehow. Some of the dead were women. More than a few were kids. One boy, just shorn in two. A girl with no legs. Not that she needed them anymore. Meanwhile, the winds turned the sky into this churning, mustard-colored gruel. You couldn't tell where the earth ended and the sky began. Every now and then, a streak of sunlight lanced through the dust, creating these silvery traces that were actually kind of cool. But otherwise, the whole fucking world seemed forgotten by God. After 3 hours of driving, we pulled off the highway in herringbone formation, the better to cover our flanks, while the squad leaders met with the platoon commanders and everybody put their heads together as to how to proceed into El Garaf. Some of us lined up along the road and test-fired our weapons to be sure the sand hadn't jammed the mags. Some of the guys took combat craps, wanting to make sure their bowels were empty before coming under fire, so they didn't blow ballast from the fear. Half hour later, we're on the road north again, passing this small cluster of shabby, low-slung houses. A trio of girls in black abayas and headscarves scramble up the soft dirt wall of a canal to wave, and Gunny tosses them a fistful of humrats. Their old man, this guy right out of the Bible, black robes, long beard, shepherd staff, he waves as well, but like he's too scared not to. Pretty soon nobody's coming out to wave. They're fleeing south, dressed in their best clothes. Girls in ruffled dresses, boys in shiny suits, the better to carry the stuff away as the RCT rolls north. Cleared hot to shoot, we set our weapons to Redcon 1, unlocking the safeties, ready to get hit and hit back. Wapa rips open an MRE packet of instant coffee, pours the crystals dry into his mouth, then chases them with a swig from his canteen. Finally, we started hearing scattered gunfire from the north. The advance companies called in artillery while civilians keep streaming past, some on bicycles, some dragging hand carts, and dogs, wild ones, they're fucking everywhere. The town's surrounded by these low clay walls, and the plan's just to charge on through unless one of the vehicles gets whacked by an RPG, and we have to rescue the crew. We're waiting there, right outside town, for the call to come over the radio. Finally, it does, and the suicide train heads into the city, single file, picking up speed.
The street beyond the gates, real narrow. You've got these three-story houses crowding in on both sides. Felt like we were barreling through a canyon. Our squad's the third vehicle in trace behind the lead Hummer in the command track, and no sooner does the lead Humvee turn the first dogleg than a machine gun opens up, firing from a minaret at the end of the block. That's another thing that messed with your head. Mosques, minarets, any kind of holy place, schools, they were strictly off limits. We were supposed to take excessive precaution to make sure we let them be. But my whole time in country, I swear, 7 out of 10 we encountered were being used as a sniper hide, machine gun nest, weapons cache, something. Anyway, soon as you realize you're under fire, your senses distort. I lost all depth perception. And Whopper, given what he said later in the hot wash, had pretty much the same thing happen. The muzzle flashes in the doorways and windows seemed to float in the air like fireflies. Ricochets pinged and whipped off the metal sides of the Humvee, the AAVs ahead and behind. The sheer volume of the gunfire we're driving into, it's terrifying. But it's weird. No shots land. Even when Fraley slows down to dodge a burning car blocking the street at this hairpin turn, I mean, the Hajis were really hopeless shots. They seemed completely unable to control their muzzle lift. And it creates this weird air of invulnerability, like there's nothing to fear except bad luck. And that can find you anywhere. Even weirder, there's this zoo of weapons going off nonstop all around you. M16s, saws, 50 cal up guns, 7.62mm chain guns, 25mm bushmasters. It should have been deafening, but it seemed like barely a murmur. Like a faucet running slow somewhere else in the house, you know? Meanwhile, Whopper and me and Gunny resort to muscle memory. Find a target, squeeze the trigger, find a target, squeeze the trigger. Up top, Mobley's pounding on the MK-19. It's jammed for the lack of LSA, a specialized lubricant the battalion commanders neglected to order enough of. I'm serious. Now Mobley's cursing, and the thud of his fist against the magazine weirdly seems louder than the gunfire. They'd trained us to expect that. Battle distortions, time dilation, heightened visual detail, sudden memory loss. By and large, though, except for the disconnect between sight and sound, me and Whopper seemed to get through okay. We maintained discipline, calling out targets, following the tracer rounds fired by Gunny to mark enemy shooters. Meanwhile, we're all trying to forget the fact the Humvee's got a soft shell, especially below. That makes it especially vulnerable to landmines. We hit one. The spall's gonna shred every man inside. Then, suddenly, poof. No sooner have we barged into town than we're spilling out the northern gate. That's the time distortion I talked about. It's like somebody lifted the top of a box. Nothing but desert for miles, which means dust, of course. Better than the smoke and the smell of gunpowder everywhere, though. Got so thick back in those tight streets, it felt like you were gargling it. We circle up so each company can dismount, work up an ACE assessment, ammo, casualties, equipment. We're focused on all that when suddenly one of the Humvees just, like, starts to vanish. It's blundered into a Sapka, this desert bog of gooey tar topped with a glaze of sand. The squad inside is scrambling out when an RPG, this white ball of flame trailing a plume of smoke, screams toward it from inside the city. The rocket lands 10 yards from the Hummer, skidding across the quicksand like a match head on oatmeal, and it duds out another 30 yards on. Meanwhile, the entire company starts taking incoming automatic weapon fire from a group of buildings just beyond the town's north wall. Gunny and the other team leader start shouting, "Take out those guns! Go, go, go!" And 4 squads of Marines charge back toward Al Garaf. Turret gunners on the AAVs are laying down covering fire with their 50 cals as we all rely again on muscle memory, weaving left and right as we run to contact. Gunny's in the lead. Whopper's on the left. I take the right. Mobley's got our 6, carrying the saw, this awesome light machine gun that just, you know, rips. Fraley stays behind with a vehicle. We make for the city wall and collapse against it. The other squads spread out left and right. Our chests are heaving, every breath feels like it's half sand, and the stuff just grinds in your throat. Just then Whopper taps my shoulder, nods toward these 3 ducks waiting in a pool of antifreeze. It's coming from a pickup with 4 flats and a windshield that's barely more than bullet holes.
We snap back when Gunny gives the signal. One by one, weapons shouldered, we charge back through the city gate. The target houses lie down an alley that parallels the city wall. This small flock of sheep is scavenging through piles of garbage, and of course it seems like there's another dog every 10 feet. Wapa spots gun barrels overhead, AK-47s, peeking over the roofline. But rather than aim, the shooters just fire off full auto bursts. Ricochets are zinging around, scattering the dogs. After a moment, the sheep take off too, but it's like they had to think about it. We break through a wood gate and scramble across the small courtyard, cluttered with lumber and sacks of cement. With a saw, Mobley sprays the opposite roof with suppressing fire as Gunny signals Whopper, take the lead. Wop cocks his leg, lifts his boot, kicks the door with all his might, practically breaks his ankle, a thing solid as a wall. He tries again, shoulder this time, same effect. Then him and me both try, shoulders, rifle butts, back to kicking, the whole time Mobley spraying the roof across the street, and brass is flying everywhere. Finally, the door budges. A gap appears. We keep kicking and shouldering and hammering with our rifle butts, and finally the thing opens just a slice, shearing away from the door jamb. A few more kicks and the thing cracks open. Gunny, then Whopper, then me, charging in as Mobley guards the rear. The entry gives way to a small room. Pillows tossed around the floor, a few rickety chairs, dull red rugs on the wall. We can smell stale cooking grease. Tin plates lie on the floor, smeared from stringy bits of some kind of meat. Goat, maybe. And as Whopper checks for a passageway leading back to the kitchen, he spots a woman crouching behind a door. She's barely taller than a kid, and she's wearing the usual long black abaya and a headscarf they call a hijab. But it's her tattoos, the line of colored dots along her chin and eyebrows that make her stand out. During training, we learned that Saddam had outlawed tattoos. They're a symptom of Western decadence. Only criminals would have them, except for certain Shiite women. The Shiites are presumed to be friendly because the Baathists, who are Sunni, have brought the hammer down over and over. And we're all, like, puzzled seeing her in this house where a gunman, a man we've come to kill, is hiding. And the guy's most likely Sunni, since that's Saddam's power base, right? Gunny gets down on one knee, the woman's eye level, so as not to seem as much a threat. He says, "Wina Zozhak, Shufni, Shufni. Where is your husband? Show me, show me." Again, my skin went cold. Finally, what Raymond had said while pounding on Carmela Vine's door made at least a little more sense, or at least had some context. Morales said, "Wasn't till then we saw the little girl. She was tinier still, no older than 6. Shabby linen dress, no shoes or socks, her hair this tangle of black curls. She had this strangely radiant face." Wapa looks at me, and we're both thinking she's not all there in the head. Then the tattooed woman points upward. Her husband's on the roof. We can't chance that she's lying, so Gunny signals that he and Mobley will clear the first floor. Me and Wapa will head upstairs. Training dictates no fewer than 2 men per room, optimally 4, but Gunny's warned the whole fire team to be ready for 1 man clears. Use frag grenades or spray the room with a saw if need be. So Whopper and me make sure our frags are handy as we hit the stairs. Weapons shouldered, we head up slow, side by side. I'm face forward, slicing the pie, aiming into the blind spots on the stair, while Whopper's got the back cover position, aiming up at the second floor landing, taking the steps blind, inching backward, feeling with his heel, making sure he never crosses his feet so he doesn't trip. We're both dripping sweat inside those stupid mop suits, and you've got to fight the impulse to wipe your face. Eyebrows feel like sponges. Meanwhile, a CH-46's rotor blades are shaking the whole house as the medevac chopper's traveling low over the city. We're almost to the switchback when a gun opens up, an AK on auto fire. It's got this distinctive scythe-like tat-a-tat, and it's deafening in the cinderblock stairwell. We both duck on instinct, but then, one instant later, again on instinct, we move to contact. Like every other Haji we've come across so far, this one's a piss-poor shot, all spray and pray, everything sailing high. We had more to worry from the plaster chewed off the walls and flying everywhere than the bullets themselves. Still, I'm standing there exposed, only half-turned, 2 steps from the switchback. Wapa rises up, full height, leans into the baluster wall to steady his aim,
sights the figure who's popped up at the top of the stair and squeezes off 3 shots. At that range, he couldn't miss. And he didn't. It's only as the shooter's twitching backwards from the rounds, though, that Wampa realizes it's a boy. Rounding the mid-stair turn in a crouch, ready to fire again, we find the kid toppled sidelong across the floor at the top. He looks older than the girl, but not by much. Early teens at best, wearing this white robe-like thing they call a dishdasha. It's already soaked in blood. He caught 2 rounds in the chest, 1 the throat, and most likely he's gonna bleed out right there if we don't call in a corpsman to treat him. The kid's eyes are glazed, and he's staring at nothing or everything. And then he starts trembling from shock. Wampa turns away and vomits. I grip the shoulder of his mop suit, push him toward the door to the roof. "We'll come back," I tell him. "But we gotta clear the whole house, you know that. Come on, you take left, I'll take right." Wampa steps over the boy, fighting the heaves, then reaches the landing and takes up position across from me on the other side of the door. This one's slatted, not massive like the one we had to break down. I signal with my hand. 1, 2, 3. Then turn, kick hard, and the door just splinters open. We charge up and out onto the roof. The light's hazy and yellowish and harsh after being inside. We're standing on pebbled tar paper, rimmed with a low stucco wall. A few scraps of laundry whip around on a clothesline. 3 goats tied to a sawhorse are straining against their tethers, scared, trying to get free. A 4th drinks from a tin washtub, unfazed. Right beyond it, we see the fluted tube of an RPG launcher. We only see the man a second later, trying to hide behind the goats. He's this scarecrow with a round, brimless kufi on his head and an AK-47 in his hands. Shaggy beard, loose black trousers, flowing white shirt with this elaborate embroidery like he's dressed himself up for some ritual. He's standing there with this expression of rage and surprise, and he starts shouting at us. I shout back, tell him in Arabic to put the weapon down. Instead, he raises it halfway to his shoulder. That's as far as he got. Wampa fires off 3 rounds. His 0 must be off, because 1 bullet sails wide, catches the guy in the arm, the 2nd misses, but the 3rd rips off his jaw. He staggers backward, not leaving his feet, not even dropping his weapon. I fire then, another 3-shot cluster, bloody up that pretty shirt. Finally, the guy falls down. We check to make sure the Haji's dead, but then it's clear we're exposed up there on the roof, so we head back inside. The smell of gunpowder's hanging in the air, but we catch something else, something musky, tallow, candle wax. It's coming from behind the closed door of the 1 room off the landing. We should have cleared that before hitting the roof, and I'm thinking we're lucky we're both not dead. Wampa reaches out, turns the knob, pushes the door open, and sweeps the room with his M16. I'm right behind, then next to him. No one's there, just a room full of candles melting down. Looks like some spacey hooker's bedroom, except there's a white prayer mat, a spread of hawk feathers, a small bowl of oil. They must have had a ritual after all, some kind of ceremony, a call to Allah for strength against the infidel. Back on the stair, I bend down and feel the boy's throat for a pulse, my fingers less than an inch from the worst of the wounds. Blood all over. My fingers, the floor, the kid, the wound in his neck. It's like a 2nd mouth. And I figure the round tore through an artery. The boy's pretty much already bled to death. Even so, I fish out the blowout kit a corpsman gave me, find the quick clot inside, try to cauterize the artery. As I'm doing this, I don't know this at the time, Wampa tells me all this later, he's noticing the thumb smudge of oil on the boy's forehead, the feathery ink mark on his neck, to gain the power of the hawk, like that makes it okay. He's not a boy, he's not a son, he's a sacrifice. And Wampa wants to head back to the roof and empty his magazine into the father's face. I get up, finally, toss down the quick clot tube, wipe the blood off my hands, smear it onto my mop suit. Somewhere outside, a Marine shouts, "Frag out!" and tosses a grenade into the neighboring house. We know it's right next door because we can feel the walls and roof shake. Meanwhile, Wampa's just standing there, like he's in some parallel universe. And I see he's, like, trembling, head to foot. I take his arm, give him a brotherly shake, tell him, we need to bust around back downstairs, help clear the other houses.
Later on, he told me he couldn't remember heading back down the stairs or rejoining the rest of the team. He just remembered the tiny, tattooed woman gripping her radiant, retarded daughter's hand and repeating the word kelp over and over as she continued pointing to the ceiling. No sorrow, eyes dry as stones. The word means dog. As far as she was concerned, that's what we were there for. Kill the Sunni dog. As for the boy, well, you know, shit happens. 10. Morales looked at his wristwatch, checked the time. He'd been talking nonstop for nearly half an hour now, and though he seemed untroubled, I couldn't imagine that was true. A few other people wandered the cafeteria in the background. Nurses' aides, patients, family members, pouring themselves coffee, pulling plates from the display cases, paying at the register, finding a place to sit. Again, I saw the wisdom of not saying anything, just letting the man be still for a moment. Besides, it would have felt too much like piping up in the middle of a prayer service. Hey, let's talk about something else. Finally, he started up again.
That night, we camped north of town and the weather turned fucking miserable. Another Shamal wind sweeps in, and that same sick rain comes with it. Those fist-sized clots of mud falling out of the sky. Felt almost biblical, you know?
Wapa digs his ranger grave next to mine and we wait out the weather, downing cold MREs, chasing them with dry coffee crystals. Once the rain stops, he drapes a rag across his lap and tears down his weapon, starts to clean it. I can see his hands are shaking, and I can't say for sure because I didn't ask him, but right then I'm guessing he can't get that kid off his mind. Can't sleep because he's afraid the boy might come to life in his dreams, confide something Wapa wants no part of. But he doesn't say anything, just pulls his M16 apart, wiping the receiver down with oil, rimming the barrel with a rag, swabbing the chamber to clear the carbon away. I can see the anger in his face, where he sits, how he moves. He's like a kettle on boil. His mind's so noisy I can almost hear him thinking, "Don't tell me it's okay." And I remember something my tia Luisa used to say. Very pious woman, very old school. She said the devil, when he wants to drive you insane, impersonates an angel and tells you you're forgiven. But I can't just leave him like that. It's not fair. So I lean over and tell him, "You did nothing wrong out there today, bro. You did your job, and you saved my life." And he turns to me, looks at me straight on. His eyes, they're glowing like his brain's on fire, like he's melting inside. Know what I'm saying? Like it takes all the power he's got not to scream in my face like an animal.
At that point, if he wasn't worn out, I certainly was. And yet, you mentioned there were three incidents that might explain what happened with Raymond. That's two. What's the third?
Morales didn't respond. His eyes were fixed on something I doubted he could see, not there in the present at least. After a moment, he shook it off, said, "It happened in Fallujah." I wasn't surprised. Where else but where Mobley died?
But you know what? I think you need to have Wapa tell you that story.
No, I thought. You're the best, most sympathetic witness I could hope for. Don't bail on me now. Like I said, he refuses.
I realize that. Wouldn't talk to me either. Not much, any rate. Not after Al-Garaf.
So Fallujah is
worse, Morales said.
I felt my insides tumble down a very high stair. All the more reason I'd rather run it through with you first. Look, I realize this can't be pleasant.
Really?
I'm sorry. I know whatever I say is likely to come across phony or idiotic or just plain wrong, but I'm trying to save Raymond's life.
I get that, he said. I do. But know what? He's the one that's got to step up. He can't slough off his business on everybody else. He's got to stop blaming himself for what he couldn't help and step up and take responsibility for what he could. I don't mean him any ill will. I really don't. You need me to testify? I will. One condition. He comes clean.
About?
He wants to cop a plea to what the war made him do, that's one thing. But no playing innocent as to what he's done since he returned stateside.
Look, don't, okay? I've read enough to know there's no doubt he shot that cop. Try to tell me different, I'll walk right now. The war wore out my patience for lies.
All right, I said, if only to diffuse his anger a little.
But I can't make promises for others. I'm not part of this trial team, and their strategy is totally up to them. But I've got a pretty good idea once they hear what you've told me tonight.
They'll see the merit in a psychiatric defense. The war's not an excuse. They won't be looking for an excuse. They'll be looking for a reason. He looked off, shook his head. Lawyers. Know what Raymond said when he shot that officer? The man's shoulder mic was on. There's a tape recording of it. He said, call the law. Ring a bell? The contempt and disgust on his face softened a little. But just a little. Know what else he said? Raymond, I mean. When he was pounding on the door of a woman in the neighborhood, trying to get her to let him in, it was in Arabic, and nobody knew what it meant at first, and even after it was translated, nobody knew why he'd said it. Care to guess what it was?
Not really.
He said, where is your husband? Show me, show me. Across the cafeteria, a woman pushing a walker lost hold of her tray. Her plate and glass crashed to the floor, shattering, followed by the clang of her fork and spoon. Everyone turned. Several people nearby rushed to help. It gave Morales and me a chance to regroup. He came back around, looked across the table, his anger a bit less defiant.
So what are you saying?
I'm saying it's not out of the question that Raymond Kersey suffered a psychotic break the day of his arrest. I think that's worth an honest look. His eyes shuddered and he shook his head, and I thought of Pandora and her immortal box, the evils of the world let loose. Nothing left behind but hope.
Tell you what, he said.
If Wapa steps up, comes clean, tells you or his sister or whoever about what happened in Fallujah so you can connect the last few dots, we're good. I'll stand beside him again, like he stood beside me. May not do him much good. Jury will look at me, look at him, wonder why we ended up so different, but I can't control what they think. No, I said, remembering the old saw. God save me from a jury of my peers. No one can. He stood up from the table and reached out his hand. I stood as well, and we shared a manly handshake, the curious ritual that always made Sitting Bull laugh.
By the way, Morales said, shouldering his valise, when you bring up Fallujah with Whopper, make sure you tell him I'm working down here in the burn ward. He'll understand.
11. As I lay awake in my hotel room near the airport that night, mulling over what I'd learned, imagining what I'd yet to hear, I found myself reflecting on what the French philosopher Simone Weil referred to as affliction. This state of being, as she conceived it, lies beyond mere suffering. It includes an element of shame as well, a sense that what's happened has rendered us fundamentally unworthy. Victims of rape, child abuse, torture, or possibly, as I was beginning to realize, combat, endure not just terrible confusion and pain, but a kind of shocking degradation that makes the grace of life, kindness, understanding, respect, feel impossibly out of reach. People look at you differently. You're damaged goods. And you find yourself locked in a kind of darkness from which there seems no escape. The only potential source of light, the only chance to return to what you think of as living, is love. But none of us gets to decide if we're loved. That's entirely out of our hands. Except for self-love, of course. The trickiest love of all. I realized now why Raymond had refused to accept his sister's concern. If she knew what he'd witnessed, worse, what he'd been part of, what he'd done, she'd want no part of him. He'd come back from the war a leper. Touch him, you die. But Joe Morales, he'd provided a workaround. Raymond believed there was no way his sister would ever really understand, and that would always qualify, diminish, undermine whatever compassion she claimed to feel. Pet him all you want. You can't turn a rat into a pony. But Morales understood. Look into his eyes and you caught a glimpse of what it was Raymond couldn't stop seeing, and Morales had offered to come forward, stand by Whopper's side. One big condition. My job was to make that condition acceptable to a man who, so far, refused to even look at my face. Sleep wouldn't come. I felt like something or someone had scraped my viscera raw. The backs of my eyelids felt sunburned. Perhaps it was because of that, or maybe because there was just too much to get my head around. All of it snarled with contradiction and freighted with pain. Maybe I was just too slow. Regardless, it wasn't till then, lying awake at 3 a.m., that I remembered what Marceline had said that first day we met. The bit about the day she told Raymond to leave, the last day the two of them spoke.
He stood there outside, the middle of the night, watching as though summoned by voices, she said, while flames engulfed the garage, licking the broken windows, blistering the paint, smoke boiling into the tree branches overhead. And now, like clicking a critical piece into place, I had Morales. Make sure you tell him. The burn ward. On the flight back home the next day, I began working out the plan ahead, thinking through what I needed to do and not do. I contacted Marceline almost as soon as I was on the ground, and she agreed to take a long lunch and meet at my office. When she arrived, I closed the door and told her to have a seat. I explained who Joe Morales was, why I'd gone to see him, and in general terms what I'd learned. I'm about to tell you some things that will most likely hit pretty hard. I know you love your brother. I can imagine that even after you've listened to what I have to say, you'll do your best to see it in a positive light. I have to ask you not to do that. She looked at me like I was Pontius Pilate. Are you telling me to lie? I'm asking you not to let Raymond off the hook. It's not what he wants. Even if it were, it won't do him any good, not anymore. She sank back into her chair, wary. What is it you're asking me to do? I need you to see this not through your eyes. I need you to take your time, listen to everything I'm about to say, and see it through the eyes of this man I spoke to, this man your brother went to war with.
But I've never met him.
I'll help you with that. The point is, I need you to walk with me through what happened like it's part of your life now. It's not a story, and you have to bear the consequences of everything that happened. She looked like I was leading her into a cage.
I don't understand. Why?
As bad as what I'm about to tell you may seem, there's worse to come. Much worse from what I gather. I need to find out what that is. And I need to find out from Raymond. No one else. But in order for me to do that, he needs to know it's okay. He needs to know no matter what he says, you can handle it. It's not enough for you to love the man he used to be. We have to convince him you can love who he's become.
How can I do that if he won't even see me?
Once we're done talking, I want you to write a letter. I'll help you with it. It may take several attempts to get it right, but we can't be reckless or sloppy or sentimental. It's the most important thing you'll ever write. I'll make sure it's delivered. She seemed baffled and a little irked.
Then what?
I took her hand, the way she'd taken mine the day we met. We wait. It didn't take several tries to get the letter right. It took more than a dozen. We worked at it through lunch, and then she returned that evening, her daughter in tow, and while the girl worked on her homework in the conference room, Marceline and I hacked through several more revisions, suffering over every word. I don't think, before that night, I ever fully realized the difficulty of balancing genuine heart with meticulous care. By 11 o'clock, we'd done the best we could hope for. Any more fussing would only make it different, not better. Marceline had brought a picture, a snapshot she feared at first might only serve to enrage and alienate her brother. On reflection, however, she decided it was worth the risk, and she added a postscript to justify it. The photo showed the two of them together in some nameless street, looking over their shoulders, the boy tall and fit, the girl pigtailed and moon-faced. She had a white cardigan on, her skirt was pleated. He wore a long-sleeved blue shirt and pressed gray slacks. Both smiled shyly at the person who'd rushed out into the street to catch them, capture this moment before they vanished for the rest of the day.
I'm sending this picture along, Raymond, not to remind you of who you were or who I was. Given what I've learned from Mr. Tierney, the things he's heard from people he's talked with, I can imagine you don't want to hear about who you once were. You'll look at this here and feel like that boy is lost forever. I don't believe that, any more than I believe the girl is gone for good. But she's very, very different. Like you, I've changed. Do you remember what Mama said right after she snapped this picture? Take care of your sister now. Can hear it like it was yesterday. And you did. You protected me. Not always, I know. I'm not saying you were perfect. But almost always. I did feel safer when you were near. If I've never told you that before, I'm sorry. Now it's come time to repay you. Please don't deny me that. Please don't make me live the rest of my life knowing you needed me and I did nothing. I don't know if I can live with myself if that happens. I can't even bear the thought. So please, Raymond, please, 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 let me help you.
I cleared my calendar for the next 2 weeks, went to the Justice Center, and asked the young lady working the reception desk to make sure Marshalline's letter reached her brother, with an additional note from me saying I would remain there in the waiting area until he agreed to meet with me. I sat down to wait, cell phone in my pocket, computer on my lap, a briefcase full of work at my feet. Come 6, the end of visiting hours, with no word from Raymond, I packed up my things and went home. The following morning, as the doors opened at 8, I reappeared, camped myself in a corner chair, and returned to my vigil. I imagined him sitting alone in his cell, reading and rereading his sister's letter. I pictured him tearing it to shreds and flushing it down the metal toilet. I envisioned him leaving it unopened on a stack of books he'd already read and never intended to touch again. This went on for 8 days. My body was raw from sitting in plastic chairs. I smelled like ammonia and despair. Then, a little after 10 a.m. on a Tuesday, an older deputy named Bill Crane, lanky build, aviator bifocals, salt-and-pepper flat-top, entered the waiting area, came up to me and said, "The prisoner's willing to meet with you now. I assume you'll want to use the attorney's room." 12. The room reserved for attorneys and their clients is windowless, cramped, and spare. Fashioned of cinder block, painted the world's most unnatural yellow. In virtually every respect, it's no different than the room used for interrogations in the basement of the police station, something the local bar has complained about for years, with nothing but a smug silence to show for the effort. There was one table, bolted to the floor at the exact center of the room, and I sat there waiting until the door swung open, and for the first time, Raymond Kersey and I were face to face. He was bigger than I'd expected, especially in the arms and chest, and I wondered if he'd been passing the time in isolation doing push-ups in his cell. I wondered how a man so large could spend an entire night on the run, evading cops and dogs and helicopters. But that spoke to his mind, I supposed, not his body. Though the picture the papers always used, his mugshot, showed him with a scruff of beard, he was clean-shaven now. His hair was cut close, too, and his features seemed chiseled from dark, pockmarked stone. His eyes resembled his sister's, except for the crackle of veins along the edges. Like Armando, he wore the obligatory jumpsuit, a white tee peeking up at the collar. Tattoo of a lightning bolt on his neck, others of indeterminate shape on each forearm. He stared at me a second, the way a fighter eyes his opponent as they bump gloves, then sat down across from me while Crane crouched down, reached under the table, unlocked the prisoner's ankle chain and looped it through a metal D-ring in the floor, locked it up again. He glanced up at me.
"You okay with the wrist cuffs off?"
"Please," I said. I offered a tight smile to Raymond. "Got nothing back." Crane undid the cuffs and Raymond rubbed his wrists. Then the older man pocketed his key ring and opened the door.
"Pound hard if you need anything. I'm right down the hall."
Once the door closed, Raymond leaned forward, rested his elbows on the tabletop, and stared right through me. I was a wrestler in high school and college. The sport provided my ticket to Stanford. I don't easily back down, and I'd prepared for this, the possibility of confrontation. Except nothing prepares you, really, until you're there. The lump in my throat felt like I'd swallowed my wallet. He took 3 deep breaths, like a lifter preparing to bang out a set. But after the last exhale, his expression softened slightly. He cleared his throat. "My sister seems to trust you." His voice sounded tight, and I wondered how recently he'd spoken to anyone. "Your sister's a very..." "What's that supposed to mean to me? Her trust in you?" Nothing quite kicks off a conversation like an unanswerable question. I said, "Nothing, I suppose, unless I earn it."
"Earn it from who? Her?"
"No," I said. "She found me and asked me to help, but I'm not working for her. Not anymore. We worked that out last time we spoke. You're the client now." The hint of a grin.
"Client." Mirth in the eyes, or mockery. "I ain't got the faintest fucking idea who the fuck you are."
"That will change," I said. "Hopefully, not before long. Point is, I'm not here to make her happy. I'm here to try to keep you from the death penalty." Like that was the wildest thing.
"I done faced the death penalty already, Slick. I faced it plenty."
Quietly, I said. "I know." We sat there, eye to eye, with a table between us for what felt like quite a while. I sat back in my chair, hands folded in my lap. Gradually, he sat back as well.
So, he said, you spoke to Mo Ellis.
I nodded. He's living in San Diego. I met him at the med center.
He told you the things Marceline mentioned in her letter. About Nasiriya, Al-Gharaf, things we saw, things we did.
Yes.
Looking down at his hands, picking at a callus. Good man, Morales. He feels the same about you.
Raymond's mouth tightened. He flinched, then crossed his arms. I said, he told me to let you know he's working in the burn ward. He said you'd understand.
It was as though the floor of his mind gave way. He looked up, and his eyes darkened. His body, though, went slack.
Yeah.
Almost a whisper. I understand. You tell him.
Another seemingly infinite moment passed, but what was time in that room?
I guess that means, he said softly, you want to hear about Fallujah.
He said the city's name like you'd find it in the Bahamas, not a rock. Fallujah, I said. Joe seemed to think it's the thing I need to know about most, but he wouldn't tell me any more than that, said it's up to you to tell me.
Raymond looked away then, across some vast emptiness where things got decided or were lost for good.
His chest rose and fell with rough breaths.
Marceline don't need to know none of this.
If that's what you want, I said. His leg began to bounce.
She's a good person. I know what she wrote about how none of this matters, how she can, you know, handle it and all. But that ain't right. She don't need this kind of thing.
His voice trailed off. He dropped his head, swallowed.
You know, oppressing her mind.
She may be stronger than you realize.
You gonna tell me about my sister now?
If I have to, yeah. His mouth twisted up like he was screwing it shut. But then, like he was leaning over a sink to wash himself, he put his elbows on the table, placed his face in his hands, and rubbed his eyes. Through his fingers, he began to speak.
13. Day before we enter Fallujah, we set up camp north of the city and load up for day work. Heavy on water and ammo. 300 rounds for each M16, 1,400 rounds for each saw. Light on food. Oranges, crackers, jalapeno cheese. Sun's lowering to the horizon, and from somewhere inside the city, a muezzin makes the call for evening prayer. They got these loudspeakers in the minarets, and this thing blasted like a banshee wail. I copped to it. Thing gave me the chills. Mobley knows this. He's like my goof-around pal. Want to play cards, hang in slang, talk tunes or movies or pussy? Mobley's the man. Morales, on the other hand, him and me, we talk about stuff. Heart to heart. Family, faith, and fear, you know. Well, once upon a time we did. All that changed once we hit the shit. Anyway, Mobley can see I got the willies. 16 in my lap. I'm breaking her down, oiling her up. When he comes on over, eyes like donuts, slaps my arm. You hear that, Wop? Check it out. And he stands up straight, sweeps his arm toward the sky like some announcer introducing the sunset. The devil prays. And darkness falls. He just stands there a second, milking it. Then busts up. Cackles like he's so damn hilarious as he walks away. Morales is there, too. He hears the whole thing. Calls out, you saying the devil's prayers are answered? And all that happens is the sun goes down? Mobley don't even turn around. He just flashes a peace sign and keeps chuckling as he moseys on off. That night, they prepped the battle space with Artie and 81s, and the explosions turned the sky red. There's this AC-130 loaded with infrared scopes. We called it Basher. It's flying overhead all night. Got 2 20-millimeter Gatling guns strafing targets below. Makes this giant washing machine sound. Swoosh, swoosh, swoosh. Got a 105-millimeter cannon, too, hitting the harder targets with 50-pound shells. We know the jihadis have had, like, months to prepare. They've dug trench lines, rigged daisy chains of explosives along alleyways, hauled buses and trucks onto the bigger streets to serve as barricades. They've also had time to plant hundreds of IEDs, stuffed into manholes, wired inside abandoned cars, rigged inside houses. You want something to think about, keep you up all night? How about 1,000 pounds of high explosive hidden inside a house, detonated when we're all inside? We're told Cobra gunships can work the flanks of the city, but not fly over downtown.
Nobody wants to repeat a Mogadishu here. Troops on the ground will have tank and mortar support against hard targets and dug-in positions. Beyond that, we're going to have to fight our way through the city, inch by inch. Don't hesitate, they tell us. A bullet arrives in a fraction of a second. Make sure it's yours. Come morning, we set out just before daybreak. Basher's gone, but there's these pioneer drones way, way overhead. Even though they're like a couple of thousand feet up, we can hear the low growl they make, like the voice of some badass angel letting us know they're spying out targets. Gave us a good feeling, got ourselves an eye in the sky. We move south into the Jolin, old center of the city, full of streets that just, you know, twist like crazy every which way. We're passing deserted souks, shuttered stores, ghost town. Civilians have been forewarned, get the fuck out of Dodge. Still, some of the stubborn ones stuck around. You'd see them in an open courtyard or a boarded-up cafe, smoking, sipping chai, saying, fuck you. Not just to us, but to Alibabas, the foreign jihadis who'd taken over the city. One point we saw three Iraqi men pushing a fourth with his legs blown off in a pushcart. Streets full of rubble, so they're zigzagging, heading toward the nearest hospital. It's like 10 or more blocks away. I'm thinking maybe the dead are the lucky ones. We're dog-trotting across these empty streets and down alleyways so dark with shadow they seem almost black. Edging block to block, two squads splitting off to cover opposite sides of the street, third squad moving ahead to clear half the next block. Like I said, most of the houses were empty, so the usual tactic was just toss a grenade over the courtyard wall, use det cord to blow the lock on the metal gate, rush a four-man fire team into the courtyard, stack against the wall of the house, and then shout and bang on the windows and doors to draw fire. Would have preferred to blow a hole in the wall of every rat trap we searched, but there wasn't enough C4 on hand in the whole damn country for that. Ironic thing, if nothing happened, nobody shot back. That's when the shit got risky. We'd smash through the door, search room by room down these long-ass hallways darker than a movie theater. If there was like an outside stair, or if we could jump roof to roof, we'd clear by going down, floor by floor, always safer that way. But most of the time, just wasn't possible. First 2 hours, we find civilians in only 2 houses. They all huddled up in the corner waving white flags as we charge on in. Kids are whimpering, parents are wide-eyed and quiet. One member of the fire team stays there, covers them, while the rest search the house. Once the place is cleared, Gunny, our team leader, tells the family, stay inside, no matter what. Then we move on to the next house. We search a couple dozen houses without incident, just beginning to settle into a nice battle rhythm, when, boom, we're catching heavy AK, RPG, and machine gun fire coming from up ahead. This ugly concrete slab of an apartment complex across the intersection. Forces the whole platoon back inside the houses we just cleared, pinning us down. Me, Mobley, Morales, and Gunny are all like trapped in this room. We grab some tables, take the doors off their hinges, fortify our position, sealing up the windows, keep out grenades and rockets. I find a firing hole and look out. See an RPG sailing toward us. Got this crazy corkscrew tail. I shout out, incoming, then duck like a motherfucker. Luckily it's a dud. Bunch of them were. They just skipped down the street, banging against walls. The ones that went off scattered dust so thick you couldn't pick out targets till the hay settled. Meanwhile, we can see muzzle flashes winking from the windows of the complex, and bullets are chewing up the sides of the house. Gunny calls in for tank support, needing 3 tries to connect because the walls of the house are so thick. The Abrams shows up, and it trains both its coax and main gun on the apartment complex. We plug our ears. The 120mm, some serious ass on that gun, rocks the whole damn street when it fires, shatters windows nearby. Then we hear the impact and everybody like cheers. I peek out through my firing hole again, and the whole front of the complex just kind of caves in slow, breaking into giant pieces. After that, the incoming fire's sporadic. The jihadis leave a few guys behind to keep us pinned down, while others scurry around to take away the dead or flee to fallback positions the next neighborhood over. And that means, rest of the day, no more empty buildings. We gonna go hunting, door to door, and they'll be waiting. Meanwhile, the Abrams just keeps pounding away. Couple minutes go by, this lone Haji comes out of a house up the block. Suicide vest, strapped to his body. His eyes are like crazy.
From dope, most likely. We came across more than one set of works in the houses we searched that morning. And though he's staggering, it's clear he's headed more or less straight for the tank. Somebody shouts, "Light that sick motherfucker up!" And I rise to my firing hole. Just about every other Marine must have too, because the guy gets hit with so much ass, it's like he's suddenly swarmed with bees. Then his bomb goes off. Shockwave knocks me 2 feet off the wall. I get my balance, stagger back to my firing hole. I see this fine red mist coming down, like rain through the dust and smoke. Then these dime-sized chunks of flesh. Tank continues with suppression fire. Two of the platoon squads join in. Third squad advances 20 yards or so across the open space, trading roles as the next squad moves up. Whole platoon leapfrogs forward this way. We clear out the last resistance in the apartment complex with frag grenades, then push to the back of the compound to eyeball the neighborhood just beyond. Place looks no different from where we've been all morning. Same shared courtyards, same concrete houses, same flat gravel roofs. Except this time, we know without doubt there's killers hidden up in there. Time we secure our recon positions, Mobley's damn near melted the barrel off his weapon. He's broadest man in the gun team, and that earns him the right to be the saw man. Whoever called it a light machine gun didn't have to lug the sucker around or haul its 200-round ammo drums. Mobley's supposed to change up after chewing through a drum, draw a cold barrel from his A-bag, and let the hot one cool for 15 minutes. But the firing's been so intense, and we've advanced so quick, he's gone through like 5 whole drums, 1,000 rounds. Barrel's fused to its plastic bipod. Discharge handle wouldn't rotate. He's just got to keep firing it hot, risking a complete barrel meltdown, or else wait however long it takes till the thing cools down. And everybody knows the decision on which way to go is going to get decided by what comes next. Gunny's glassing the distant houses, checking for movement. He doesn't see any, but he whispers to stay frosty. The Hodges know to keep back from the open windows now, so their muzzle flashes don't give away their positions. We head down to the street, make our way forward. Suddenly, this girl, no older than 10, comes out of a doorway into the street. Long black hair, simple white dress, no shoes. She's got a torch in her hand. Gunny tells everybody, "Hold your fire." Girl's got this look of terror on her face. But she kicks into a run and reaches this 55-gallon drum in the middle of the street, filled with some filmy black fluid. Not just oil, something else. Drops the torch in, spins right around, runs back the way she came. Drum erupts like woof, low blue flame. And in no time, this thick black cloud of smoke is damn near everywhere. Girl darts back to the house she came out of. I'm down on my belly so I can see, and I've got her sighted. Finger off the trigger. She stares at the door a second like she can't believe it. Thing shut tight. She tries the handle. Locked. She pounds on the wood, cries out once, twice, then over and over, slapping at the door with her open hands, sobbing and screaming like I had this fleeting urge to shoot. Like I could turn this shit around. Spare her having to relive what was happening here for the rest of her life. But she spares me that. She gives the door one last crack, pounding with her fists, then utters a sound I didn't think could come from a human being. She runs off then, arms flapping at her sides. She vanishes around the next corner. 2 seconds, maybe, till we hear the shot. The Hodges inside the house had radioed a sniper to take her out. She's running away from our position. She's no threat to them. Don't matter. Boom! She's gone. Gunny says, "Bet they don't show that on Al Jazeera tonight." I pull the spent mag from my M16, draw a fresh one from my A-bag, slap the clip against my helmet to bang clear any misloads, then shove it home into my weapon. Something about the girl, about how it went down, I don't know, but I'm finally totally locked in. I'm ready and willing. Time to hunt. Time to kill. Gunny gets on the radio, calls in a mortar strike on the house the girl came out of. Moments later, the 81s rain down. There's this satisfying boom and crack as the shells hit. Debris flies everywhere. Then a landslide sound as the roof collapses. 2 more mortar rounds hit the rubble. I'm thinking, too bad the kid can't watch this. Gunny just rises to his feet and gestures the whole team forward. We're back on the move. House the mortars hit is 1 of 4 in a compound. We gotta clear the other 3.
First two are empty, though inside we find greasy plates and cups of tea, still warm. We get to the last house, got the front door breached, whole fire team inside, when we smell the food. Roasting goat, lemon, mint, something else I find out later's called tamarind. A woman's voice calls out to us in Arabic from a room toward the back. She sounds like she's asking for help, but we've been told the Mujahideen rigged doorways with charges, then use women as decoys, forcing them to lure Marines forward. Sometimes dinner's on the stove, an especially clever touch. It's a trick masterminded by the Chechens. The Syrians and them are the most cutthroat of the Alibabas who stayed behind for the siege. The Imams, of course, deny they're even there. Only brave Iraqis, they say, are defending the city against the Crusaders, the occupiers. Gunny calls out in Arabic, and we all wait for a response. Then I spot two grenades rolling toward us across the concrete floor. I've got like a millisecond to shout out, and everybody charges back at flash speed, diving for cover. But Mobley's dragging the saw, those ammo drums. The explosions, tag team. It's like lightning cuts the air in two, then two again. Then this thunderclap, double boom, followed by AK fire from somewhere near the back of the house. I can see the muzzle flashes crackling through the smoke. Brass is chiming on the floor. Me and Morales answer with suppression fire while Gunny crawls forward toward Mobley. He's screaming, but I don't even recognize the voice. Blast has ripped his leg in two just above the knee. He's bleeding out so fast he's already convulsing from shock. And by the time Gunny reaches him, he can't even talk no more, much less scream. Calling for Corman's pointless. Mobley's dead before we can fight back the Hodges long enough to drag him out into the courtyard. Severed half of his leg still inside the house. This point, the rest of the platoons rush forward to surround the target, seal it up. Captain tries to call in a tank, a mortar hit, but the TACnet's jammed up. There's units all over the city under fire, facing fortified bunkers, calling for support. Meanwhile, the Hodges inside the house keep taking their shots, spraying AK fire in our positions. I spot this black iron cistern on the roof, propped on a metal stand. Iraqis use them to store cooking oil. I open fire, plug the thing with holes. 50 gallons of oil begin to seep down through the ceiling. Sensing where this is headed, Gunny turns to the captain. Sir, what about the woman inside? Captain just looks up at that chugging drool of oil on the roof, says, there is no woman inside. That's all anybody needs to hear. I take out 3 incendiary grenades, and before anybody can offer a second guess, I heave them through an open window on the second floor. Mobley's body's dumped against the courtyard wall, eyes and mouth open, covered with dust. I want to feel what I'm supposed to feel, but I can't, and I hate him for that. Hate myself, hate the fucking captain and every cocksucker ranked above him all the way back to D.C. But most of all, I hate the fuckers inside that house. That's when I hear the explosions inside, one on top of the other. I watch as first comes this crackling light, then the flames catch hold, like Friday night in hell. I hear the screams next. I tell myself, that's what answered prayers sound like. This is what they look like. Whole time I'm listening for a voice might be a woman's. Raymond drifted away for a moment, leg bobbing like a jackhammer, eyes drilling the opposite wall. I let him sit. Caught up in my own reflections. Call the law, I thought. Hold the applause. Next 6 hours, me and the rest of the platoon search 54 houses without a fight. We come across civilians. It's usually some family huddled round a body they've rolled up in a blanket or a rug. Wait until the Americans pull out so they can bury whoever it is. Late in the day, command calls off the searches. Can't do room to room after dark. No depth perception with NVGs. We'll end up tripping on stairs, angling wrong as we rake the rooms with clearing fire, end up shooting each other. We pull up for camp same time the Army, PSYOPs, crews start roaming the city in their Humvees, cranking out all sorts of nasty shit. And I mean, loud. Sounds of men and women screaming, cats fighting, guns and roses, welcome to the jungle. The favorite, though, seems to be the creature's laugh from Predator. They play it with amped-up bass at 100 decibels, and it echoes all over, bouncing off the pavement, the concrete walls of the houses and apartment buildings, like some demons taking over the city. Guys hunker down, and stories start to circulate about things they found during the house-to-house.
Weapons hid up inside schools and mosques. A torture chamber where some guy's hanging from chains, starving. Turns out he's the driver for two French journalists still missing. Thing that pisses us off the most? One squad found this safe house filled with Iraqi National Guard uniforms. The insurgents intended to slip them on, infiltrate the American lines, dressing up like the Hundis, Iraqi troops, guys who came along that day, walk with us side by side. 7 tons in Amtraks come up from the rear, and the Pogues upload ammo and food. I restock my A-bag, then fake my way through an MRE, something called Hoppin' John. Couldn't taste nothing. My camis are soaked through with sweat. I haven't slept in over 40 hours, and it's getting cold. I realize it's sunset, and like not 10 seconds later, I catch the sound of the muezzin, the evening call to prayer. I remember the joke from the night before, which now feels like 1,000 years ago, thinking, yeah, right, the devil prays, and his prayers get answered. The girl, the sorry drugged-up vest jockey blown to bits, Mobley, and it clicks finally. If the devil prays, who the hell's he praying to but God? Same God my mother prayed to every day of her life, right up till the minute she died. Keep my boy safe. Bring him home to his sister. Cue the choir. Give me a big amen. Same damn God. Which means he's in on it. All of it. Him and the devil joined at the hip. You want to behold the handwork of the Lord? Feel his heavenly grace? Look the fuck around. I am the Lord thy God, and my name is Fallujah. Raymond dropped his gaze. The seconds that passed felt like minutes. In a much softer voice, he said finally, But that ain't the punchline. You ready for the motherfucking punchline? I suppose, I said. Yes, around 10 that night, the intel guys come through. They were at the site where we roasted the Alibabas, and they're looking for the unit involved. They find their way to us, and this lieutenant, looks like he's all of 15, comes up. You can tell he's educated, but he's playing up his accent like he's the kingfish or some shit. Says, which one of y'all is Greg Maddox? Me and Morales and Gunny, we all look at each other like he's talking some other language. Then it dawns on me Maddox pitches for the Braves. Lieutenant must be some kind of fan. He wants to know who threw the grenades. I tell him I did. He looks at me with this big-ass smile. But his eyes don't quite come along. Like he's bummed I'm black, but he can live with it. Reaches into this satchel, pulls out an 8x10, says, Know what that is, Marine? I look at the picture. It's the burned-out interior of the house from what I can make out. Floor's been tore up, concrete hacked away. There's something in the dirt size of a cabbage and charred black, like a big chunk of coal. Then I see there's 2 more just like it, not far away. I hand the picture back. No, sir, I don't recognize that. Lieutenant grins like him and me, we're pals now. We got ourselves a little secret. That's a human head, Maddox. A woman's. She's buried up to her neck. That's what they do when they think a woman's cheated on her man or read a book. Who knows what these 3 did? And I'm thinking about the woman's voice we heard. Maybe she's the mother of the girl with the torch, the one the Haji sniper took out. And I can't explain it. But all of a sudden, I'm thinking about my own mother. I'm looking at these women I burned alive, and I'm seeing, and the girl, the one who ran, pounding on the door, trying to get back in, I'm thinking, Marshalline. Can't explain why. My mind's just kind of wandered off to another place. Meanwhile, the lieutenant's handing me a second picture. This one's of the other 2 women. It's real close up. I can see something different, but then I don't want to see. And I try to give the thing back, but the lieutenant says, Take a guess what that is. The crisscross stuff on the women's lips, I mean. What's left of their lips? Any thoughts? Any ideas? It's wire. Real fine wire. Kind used for beadwork. Motherfuckers used it to sew the women's mouths shut. I'm about to get sick at that point. Lieutenant straightens up, turns to the rest of the squad. That's the enemy, gentlemen. That's the kind of savages we're here to kill. You brought hellfire today. Get some rest. Gonna be a long one again tomorrow. He gives me this big slap on the shoulder, and I drop the picture. I don't want to pick it up, like it's going to burn my skin if I touch it. So he bends down, lifts it up, slips it back in my hand, says, That's yours to keep, Maddox. 14.
I spent another 2 hours in that room with Raymond. He'd never said those things aloud to another person, and I sensed not just his sorrow, but his fear and resentment at being heard out. And who was I? A stranger. But so often it's precisely a stranger we turn to when it's time to own the darkness. I just sat there in the silence with him for a while, hoping the charge in the room might dissipate with time. Finally, I said, "Have you ever heard of a woman named Antigone?" He looked up. "You gonna tell me a story now?" "Bear with me," I said. "It's relevant." He folded his large, dark hands, rested his chin on his thumbs, shrugged. "It's an old story, and there are several versions, but in the one I know, Antigone is the sister of two brothers, Eteocles and Polynices, who are co-rulers of Thebes. They're supposed to share the reign, taking turns, but when it comes time for Eteocles to surrender the throne, he refuses. Polynices raises an army and attacks the city. In the battle, both brothers are killed. The rebellion is put down, though, and a man named Creon takes over. In the time the story was originally told, civil war was common. Ordinary people understood that rebels had to be crushed without mercy. This was certainly Creon's take on the matter. As a punishment, he refused to allow the body of Polynices to be buried. Instead, it was left for the rats and dogs and birds to eat. Antigone considered this sacrilege. She begged Creon to let her bury her brother. He refused. And so she went out in the middle of the night and did it in secret. Creon found out, of course, and had her brought before him. I stopped, wondering how all this was landing. Raymond said, "Go ahead. I'm listening." "Well, like I said, there are a lot of versions. In the one I know, she defends herself, saying she knows she defied the law, but there's a higher law that demands she not abandon her brother. For that, she gets sealed up in a cave, where she hangs herself. In other variations of the story, Creon's son is in love with her and helps her escape. One version even has Hercules making an appearance, but that's somewhat beside the point, given why I brought up the story."
"You brought it up," Raymond said, "because of Marceline."
"Pretty much," I said. "I'm trying to figure out a way that somehow you and I can come up with a way to keep her from being sealed up in a cave. I'd like to say from that point on it got easier, but just because a man discovers there might be a way out of hell doesn't mean he sees much point in leaving. I visited him every day for a week after that, though twice he refused to meet with me. I encouraged Joe Morales to fly up, paid his airfare so he could, and he and Raymond spoke alone for several hours. Next, I enlisted Mike Dunleavy, with his snowy hair and beard, his Falstaffian girth, and he agreed to consult with Raymond as a veteran, the way he would any other. Play Ariadne to Raymond's Theseus, offer a thread in the maze. Help him understand that even alone in a cell, there are choices. Finally, he agreed to see his sister. By that time, I'd found her another job, one with a law firm in Napa, where her identity as Raymond Kersey's sister wouldn't be an issue. As chance would have it, their visit occurred the exact same day as the first anniversary of Kevin Tamburo's murder. Several hundred supporters staged a rally outside the Justice Center, featuring members of his family honoring his life, remembering his death. You could hear the speakers at the podium, even inside the detention area, and I wondered how much that affected what went on between Raymond and Marceline. Word had leaked out about his seeing Dunleavy, and some folks were outraged at the suggestion Raymond might use his war service in his defense. "It's shameful," one veteran told reporters, "and dishonors the sacrifice so many men and women in uniform have made on behalf of their country." It was clear there would be not just an uproar, but something more akin to open revolt. Protests on the courthouse steps, a vigil during trial, if Raymond's defense team pointed out that he was probably suffering a psychotic episode, or was even in a fugue state at the time he killed Corporal Tamburo. My job isn't to make people happy, of course, or to bow to their convictions, no matter how deeply or honestly felt. My duty was solely to Raymond. But after that day and his meeting with his sister, he locked himself away for several weeks, refusing to see me or anyone else on his legal team. The only visits he granted were from Mike Dunleavy, and even they were sporadic. Marceline felt puzzled by this turn toward isolation, because there was nothing in what she and Raymond had said when they were together that suggested he'd suddenly hole up alone like this. She felt hurt that he refused to see her when she came to the jail and worried she'd somehow sent him into a depressive tailspin. Mike calmed her fears a little on that front, but in answer to specific questions about what was happening, what Raymond was thinking or saying, Mike would only reply, "These things take time." Finally, I and the other lawyers on his team, the two from the public defender's office assigned to his case, received word he wanted to meet with us. We crowded into the tiny room and waited for Raymond to appear. The obligatory motion for change of venue was pending, as well as several discovery motions for Brady materials. Any agreements the prosecution had made with Raymond's accomplices and the wrecking crew for their testimony, plus any evidence, including the detective's interview notes, that might challenge their credibility. We were hashing all that through when the door opened and the deputy let Raymond in. He seemed different than the last time I'd seen him. Less defiant, though not quite serene. We tried to assure the deputy that securing his ankle chains wasn't necessary. We felt perfectly safe with our client. But he advised us the shackles weren't for our safety, but his, when he returned to take Raymond back to his cell. The door closed. We muttered our greetings. Raymond cut us off. "I want you to listen to me. I've been thinking long and hard about the best thing to do. For me, my sister, the family of Officer Tamburo, everybody. I've gone over it and over it, and I've made up my mind. You don't go along, I'll ask for different lawyers. We clear?" No one seemed surprised. You work criminal defense, you hear this all the time. What you don't hear is what came next. "I won't offer a psychiatric defense. I know it's my right, and I know there's facts to support it, but I won't do it. I can't just pretend the 10 years between when I came back and when I shot that officer never happened. It don't matter. I intend to plead guilty to the charges. I'll put myself at the mercy of the court. I can live with that, and that's all I can live with. You want to argue? I'll call for the guard. Understand?" He looked at each of us in turn, lingering on me. No expression. "Now what do we have to do to make this happen?" As you can imagine, it wasn't as simple as that. When your client is charged with a capital crime, you have an obligation to override any wishes he may have to pitch himself under the guillotine's blade. Psychiatrists have to confirm he's neither delusional nor depressed. If you're smart, you have outside counsel confer with him to make sure he doesn't, with different lawyers, come to a different decision. We did all that over the course of the ensuing year. Raymond held firm. He'd made his peace with his unmedicated conscience. Meanwhile, we went back and forth with the prosecutors, seeing if we could get a recommendation for life without parole in exchange for the plea of guilty. The district attorney gets elected here, not appointed, and sparing Raymond's life wasn't popular with his voter base, to put it mildly. In the end, he'd only agree not to push for the death penalty, leaving the ultimate decision to the judge. On the day he entered the courtroom to receive his sentence, Raymond wore a simple blue suit, white shirt and striped tie I'd bought for him. He'd slipped the items on in the hallway connecting the jail with the court. I helped him knot his tie. A crowd filled the courthouse steps and lobby, some of them holding signs that read, "Remember Kevin, not his killer. Common sense equals death for senseless murder, and the old reliable, an eye for an eye." Some placards contained merely pictures of the slain officer, in his blues, courtside with the girls he coached, at a restaurant with his wife on their anniversary. A couple of those bore the man's trademark expression, "Good enough ain't good enough." News crews prowled everywhere except inside the courtroom. The judge, an imperious old hand named Herman Culpepper, issued an 11th-hour order barring TV cameras from the hearing. In chambers, he told the attorneys for both sides that he wouldn't let this proceeding devolve into a circus. It'll be lively enough as is. He, too, like all Superior Court judges, was elected. Kevin Tamburo's widow and two daughters, dabbing their eyes or clutching each other's hands, sat right behind the prosecutor's table. Dozens of other family and friends, fellow officers in uniform, players from his teams, including Anita Ramirez, who avoided eye contact, plus a throng of other supporters filled the courtroom, their expressions ranging from stern to heartbroken to patiently watchful. Raymond's lone supporter beyond his legal team was his sister. Marshalline sat in the row right behind us, prim and plain in a light brown suit. I'd promised to run interference for her with the press and to keep her name out of the news, which she appreciated, she said, more for the sake of her daughter than herself. The girl was in school, and even the principal remained unaware of who her uncle was. I turned back to check in with her and noticed, sitting beside her, a husky man with short-cropped hair and a lantern jaw, bulging out of a well-worn sport coat. He stared straight ahead, eyes flinty, unblinking, hands clasped tight in his lap. A red, white, and blue button on his lapel read, "Your Honor, Honor the Law." Suddenly the bailiff called out, "All rise," and as Marceline and the large man beside her rose to their feet, she pressed forward, reached for her brother's sleeve, grabbed it, turned him toward her so they were face to face, then leaned over the partition and pulled him to her, pressing her cheek to his and whispering, "I'm right here." For that, too, is the law. This has been an Audible Studios production of The Devil Prayed and Darkness Fell, written by David Corbett, performed by David DeVries, producer Mike Charzik, copyright 2015 David Corbett, production